own LBC New Year's Honours list. Henry Reilly, OBE. Maybe MBE. At 11, both Keir Starmer and Kemi Badenoch are 7-4 on to be replaced as party leaders in 2026. Which party leaders will still be leader next December and why? And at 12, a new report out today says that a third of us believe you can't be British if you're not born in the UK. Surely that's ridiculous. But what does being British actually mean? Is it based on ancestry, residence, values or heritage? Or all four?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, figure skaters Jane Torval and Christopher Dean say they're thrilled to be recognised on the New Year's Honours list. Actor Idris Elba has been knighted and Lionesses manager Serena Wiegmann has been made an honorary dame. Teacher, author and broadcaster Bobby Seagull, best known for his appearance on University Challenge, has received an MBE. He's told LBC how he broke the news to his family.
I was thinking, can I put this on my family WhatsApp group? But I thought, like, this deserves more than just a thumbs up or smiley face emoji. So I saw my family one by one or in little groups in person, and I gave them the letter. And I said, oh, I think I've got jury duty. And they were like, oh, that's really fascinating. And then they took the letter and they opened it up. And my dad, bless him, I think I saw a tear in his eye.
Anthony Joshua has remained in hospital overnight following a crash in Nigeria which killed two members of his team. Sina Gami and Latif Ayadeli died when the jeep they were travelling in crashed into a stationary truck. Senior reporter at the Daily Mail, Nick Pisa, shared more details with LBC.
They're two of his very best friends, actually. He's been with them for years. They're trainers with him, both British nationals. In fact, Sina owns a gym in the Harrow area of London called Evolve, which have put out a statement overnight on social media saying that they are going to be closed today as they mourn the passing of their owner.
Police have ended their investigation into the disappearance of a Royal Navy sailor almost 40 years ago. Simon Parkes was last seen in December 1986 when the ship he was serving on was docked in Gibraltar. His disappearance has previously been part of an investigation into a man who murdered two men also serving on board at the same time. The Foreign Secretary has ordered an urgent review into the case of Ala Abdel Fattah over the emergence of social media posts. The activist appeared to call for violence against Zionists and the police. He has since apologised, but there are calls for his British citizenship, which was granted in 2021, to be revoked. And a union says thousands of its female members feel unsafe and embarrassed because they're forced to wear PPE designed for men. A survey by GMB found a fifth claim they couldn't do their job as a result. Problems included gloves becoming caught in machinery and respirators that don't seal properly. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 18 points at 98.85. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the south and east with brighter spells developing. A few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good morning. It's 3 minutes past 10 on LBC. It's Ian Dale here with you until 1. I want to start talking about the New Year's Honours List because I'm the kind of geek that really used to get quite excited about the New Year's Honours List or the Queen, as it then was, Queen's Birthday Honours List in June. Not so much nowadays, though, because I think the honours system has become rather devalued over the years. And that people are being honoured now at a point in their career where they're nowhere near the end of their career. Surely the honours system should honour people who have achieved an awful lot in whatever line of work they're doing, It's not just about celebrities. It's not just about politicians. It's not just about sports people. It has become more and more about acknowledging the work that individual people do in their communities, and that's a good thing. But I looked through this year's list, and there are quite a few people who I would say are in the middle of their careers. And you think, well, why would you honour somebody in the middle of the... It's like when a football team does well. I mean, England obviously haven't won anything, certainly in the men's football in recent years. But I never quite understood why everyone was clamouring for David Beckham to get an honour and then get a knighthood. Now, he's done a lot of charitable work, so I suppose he's got it in part for that. But then you look at the England women's football team, and they have been acknowledged in the honours list, but only Serena Wiegmann, the manager, and a couple of the players. And you think, well, what about the others? What about Chloe Kelly, the woman who actually scored the goal to win the European Championship? And you just think, well, why are some acknowledged and others not? And it was the same with the England men's World Cup winning team in 1966. You'd have thought that all of them should have deserved some sort of honour, whether it's an MBE, OBE, CBE. In a sense, it doesn't really matter the level of the honour. But it took ages for some of them to get an honour, and that's surely wrong. So I want to hear your views on the honour system in general. Do you think that it needs to be reformed? But also, I want to ask you this. Who would you nominate for an honour? If we had an LBC New Year's Honours list, who do you think should be on it? And I'm not talking about LBC presenters. I'm talking about people that either in the wider world that you really respect and you think they deserve an honour, or people in your local community. Maybe a friend that you know who's just gone that extra mile but gets scant little recognition for it. And you think, well, this person ought to have an honour in the normal honours list, but it's just reserved for the likes of, and I make no sort of comment on whether the fact these people deserve them or not. I mean, I think like Jane Torval and Christopher Dean, I think we can all think that they absolutely deserve, in his case, a knighthood, in her case, a damehood, because they won Olympic medals. They brought so much pleasure to people over the course of the last, 40 years or so. So why not give them an honour? Quite happy with that. Idris Elba, he's been knighted. You could say, well, he falls under the system. Well, he's still a really famous actor. Why not wait a bit? 0345 6060973 is the number to call. As I say, the England captain and two-time European champion Leah Williamson, she's made a CBE. Ella Toon, Kira Walsh, Alex Greenwood and Georgia Stanway, they're all given MBEs to recognise their contribution to the England triumph. And then in the world of entertainment, you've got Mira Sayal. She gets a damehood, an OBE for Warwick Davis, and sports broadcasters Clive Tilsley and Gabby Logan. So, I mean, if you want to comment on any of those, absolutely fine. But I'm more interested to know what kind of person do you think should get an honour in the honours list? And if we're creating an LBC honours list, your nominations, please. 0345 6060973. Dr. Craig Prescott is a law lecturer and expert on the British Constitution at Royal Holloway University. He's writing a book on the future of the monarchy. Craig, very good morning. Why do we have an honours system and how did it originate?
Essentially, we have an honours system because we are a monarchy, ultimately, and it is the king who is the fount of all honour in this country. And, you know, it is derived from history. We can go back to Edward II and creating the Knights of the Garter, which still exists today. We can go back to sort of creating peerages. That's a different branch of the honour system to what we're talking about today. But it is the same principle that the king used to confer honours in order to gain favour from people. And over the centuries, that's developed into a series of different orders and different honours. And in the modern world, it's morphed into recognition for service or good works or achievement. So it's something that has just developed relatively organically over the past 800 years or so.
There seem to be fewer honours for politicians nowadays, but the civil servants, I mean, they still seem to dominate the honours list.
Yes, there is actually a specific order for senior civil servants called the Order of the Bath, which, you know, has always been reserved for, you know, people in public life. And so I think that's one reason. There has been sort of criticism in the past of politicians perhaps getting honours too easily. I think there were a series of conservative ministers, and, you know, they were a cabinet minister for 5 minutes, and then 6 months later they've ended up with a knighthood. And so I think, you know, there might have been a recalibration on that. It's helped that you've had a government that, you know, has had fewer cabinet reshuffles that's led to sort of those sorts of issues arising at the moment. So the honour system does warp and weave and change over the years.
How do people get nominated for honours? Because that system has changed in the last 20 years, hasn't it? Because you or I could go onto a government website and nominate someone for an honour, which you couldn't have done many years ago.
Yes, absolutely. It was John Major who strived to open up the honours list as long ago as the early 90s. But yes, now anyone can nominate anyone else for an honour. And there are several committees in Whitehall that then consider the nominations and perhaps consider anyone else that they feel worthy of an honour. And, you know, they sort of meet sort of several times a year to construct the honours list. You know, sport is something that's become much more honours friendly, shall we say. You talked about the 1966 World Cup winning side. It's sort of, in those days, not many sports people got honours. Mm. But again, in changes made in the past 20 years or so, sport has become a big element of the honours system, which perhaps reflects the importance of sport today, which in a sense wasn't the case 40, 50 years ago.
Is it the case that you can nominate yourself for an honour? Because I think that's the only way I'm ever going to get one.
Well, you might be surprised in the fullness of time. I don't think you can nominate yourself for an honour. I don't think the Honours Committee would look very kindly on someone nominating themselves for an honour. That's not how it works, really.
No, well, I would have thought so, but I'm sure someone told me that you could do that. Anyway, we'll leave that to one side. Do you think that there is any political will for the honours system to be completely revamped? I mean, it is a bit odd for people still to have the Order of the British Empire. It's been suggested that should be changed to the Order of British Excellence.
Yes, I think this is something that, you know, the time might have come to look at this. You know, the Order of the British Empire was created in 1918 to reward service for the First World War. And it was designed to be an honour that was open to everyone in a way that perhaps other orders at the time weren't. And it's sort of, I think there might be a sense that for some people, the title British Empire is not something they want to be associated with. So given the idea was for this to be an order for everyone, I think it perhaps makes sense to look at that and perhaps to change it to something like the Order of British Excellence or something along those lines. Because that idea of the British Empire doesn't have much purchase now. 1918 was very, very different. And, you know, 2014, 2050 will be very different again. And I think if you look into the future, it'll become even odder to have to be a member of something that no longer exists.
What do other countries do? Do you know?
So the vast majority of other countries have some sort of honour system. You know, the French has the Legion d'Honneur. My French pronunciation isn't very good, but they have, their own honor system. Even, republics have an honor system of sort. In the US, there are various honors awarded by the president, but also perhaps unusually also by Congress. They can award honors for those who they deem sort of worthy. And so most countries have some sort of honor system. The feature with the UK is that it is the most developed and most complex in the world, in that there are these different orders. There's a Royal Victorian Order for service to the monarchy. There's the Order of the Bath that I mentioned, the Order of the Garter, the Order of the Thistle, the Order of the British Empire. You can go on and on. And there might be an argument for rationalizing some of that and simplifying it so that people can understand the honor system a bit better.
Craig, thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Craig Prescott there, law lecturer and expert on the British Constitution at Royal Holloway University. Now, let's take a couple of texts and then we'll come to your calls. And I'm particularly looking for your nominations for people who you think have just gone that extra mile. Somebody who's a real pillar of maybe your local community. Somebody who just goes beyond what they need to do and should have some recognition for it. JJ in Deal says, Ian, I should be nominated for the honours list for putting up with my wife for 22 years. I would counter that, JJ, and say perhaps she should get an honour for putting up with you for 22 years. Just a thought. Joe says, good morning, Ian. I'm nominating you. Well, thank you very much indeed. And she says, I can even choose my own title. Well, if you're nominating me for a peerage, that would be very much appreciated because I do look very good in ermine. I'm sure many people would disagree. 0345 6060 973. And do you think that the honour system has almost outlived its usefulness? It needs to be completely revamped. Maybe we should have some sort of honour system. But you think that given some of the people who've been nominated for honours over the years who've turned out to be wrong'uns, maybe it just needs a little bit of an update. 0345 6060 973. It's 16 minutes past 10.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like. From real Octopus Energy calls.
Your customer service was tip-top. I couldn't fault it.
The customer service was really good.
The people are friendly on the telephone. You can always get a problem solved.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
When you're smiling...
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Darling, nothing beats that just booked feeling. Because when you book a jet-to holiday, you start dreaming of pool days and seeing the sights. Get ahead for summer with just a £25 deposit per person for a limited time only. Choose from our best rooms and hotels and save £200 per couple. Nothing beats a jet-to holiday. Package holidays you can trust. Astronatural protected. £25 deposit available from 19th of December to 12th of January. Subject to availability and conditions.
Thinking about goals this time of year? Like saving money or buying a new car? Well, right now you can save £3,750 on the all-electric Mini Countryman with the electric car grant. Yep, two goals in one and you get more space, more adventure, more Mini than ever. I feel a cheeky little smile coming on. Start living the big life for less and save £3,750 with the electric car grant. Visit mini.co.uk/grant. Grant available for specifications up to £42,000. T's and C's apply.
At ulisprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulisprosperity.com.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
18 minutes past 10 on LBC. Colin says, the great Alan Bennett should get an honour, but I'm not sure he would accept a knighthood. That is something that is worth noticing, that there are some people who are nominated for honours who refuse to accept them. I remember my friend Yasmin Alibi Brown, she was awarded an MBE, and then she accepted it, and then for reasons I can't quite remember, she returned it to the palace. A lot of people we never know whether they've been offered them or whether they've accepted them. And I suppose it's up to the individual. If you don't want to accept it, there's no reason that you should be forced to. Greg says, me, I brought up 4 kids, 2 with autism, and I haven't broken any laws. I give to charity every month, and once donated an old phone to a homeless person who had lost theirs. Now, does that qualify for an honour? It means you're a good person, Greg. We'll let everyone else judge as to whether that merits an honour. Mark says, Sophie Ellis-Bextor deserves a damehood. She kept us going through lockdown and works like a trooper. You see, she would come under the category of somebody who I think is too young to get an honour. Yes, she has achieved a lot as a singer, and I think she's... I was on Jeremy Vine's show with her once, a thoroughly nice person. But should she get an honour at this stage in her career? I'm not so sure. Nothing against her. Medina says, an LBC nomination list. Your amazing caller on Christmas Day, who was over 100. Sadly, I don't recall her name. Well, I would absolutely nominate Constance in Woking. And Constance, if you're listening, give us a call. Would you accept an honour? I think that it's for services to LBC that you should get an honour, because all of your calls are fantastic, and everyone listening absolutely loves you to bits. So I think that's a very good nomination. Patrick is in Morden. Hello, Patrick.
Ian, good morning to you.
Morning.
So I believe the following are worthy of an honour, and you won't really know them. I'll tell you who they are after I've given their names. So there's Ed Hall. There's Duncan Lustig. There is Craig Jones. So three there of critical importance. Who are they? They're people who've been involved over the last 3.5 decades in getting, as you know, the ban on LGBT people serving in the military lifted, but also to obtain reparations. And this year, we're in the 25th anniversary year of the ban having gone. Only a few months since the King opened our memorial in the National Memorial Arboretum. So these are people who are not normally visible, but who've done made an enormous contribution to changing the lives for many people. It's those who I believe should get nominated. And one of the faults of the current system is that unless you're put forward within the military or within the Foreign Office, someone has to put in quite a detailed application with supporting testimonials. And unfortunately, you know, many people do that, but a lot don't get that done for them, and they therefore get passed by.
I think the generality of what you said, I completely agree with, because there are so many people who are unsung heroes who have managed to change the law, influence things, who you never hear of, apart from when maybe there's a couple of newspaper articles about whatever they've achieved. But I think the people that you mentioned there would be fully deserved of some sort of honour.
I certainly am working on that with others, certainly for one of them, hopefully another one. But it's a long, tedious process. And there are some occasions when you think, crikey, their achievements are known very widely by a lot of influential people. No one has bothered to put them up. It's being left to people like myself and others to go through all that hard work. I've also got just a comment on the need for reform, which I think is essential. You hear a lot about the royal family modernising more, and I think our honour system, and I believe in the public recognition of people's good work, does need some reform. And I think one of your last callers mentioned the Order of British Excellence. I like that less so. I would prefer the Order of Britain, noting that there is also the Order of Canada, there's the Order of Australia, and I think that would be better. I'd also look at the different lines of it. You're probably aware that the lowest award is the British Empire Medal.
Mm.
Now, one of the good things that John Major did whilst Prime Minister was remove that and say, look, if you're good enough to get a British Empire Medal, you're good enough to get an MBE, and made the member of the British Empire the lowest step in. And unfortunately, I think the British Empire Medal brought it back.
I was going to say, because it does still exist, doesn't it?
It was brought back
right.
by David Cameron. I think that rather devalues people, because if you look at today's list, which I might admit I'm a little bit sorry has been released earlier than it normally is. I rather look forward to New Year's, you know, day and having a good sort of rummage through it.
It's always been released on the 30th.
Has it? Yeah. I stand corrected. I obviously only get to it myself on the 1st.
No, because we get an embargoed list of it. I think it's embargoed till 10:30 on the 29th. So it can then be in the papers for the 30th, and it gives people a chance to sort of prepare their articles.
That's very good and nice to know. Well corrected. But if you look at that list, you look down at the BEMs, the people who have done good works locally, and I just ask myself, it's a slight devaluation. Given an MBE, I think John Major was right here. The only other thing is that there's two orders of, in some of the orders, there are two orders of knighthood. And I know that some people, who don't agree with the British Empire bit, might also wish there to be something else there. And I've heard a number of people say, rather than being a knight or a dame, you could be a citizen of Britain. And that being a third term, I think quite a few of those who do turn down knighthoods or damehoods would probably think again if that was done. So there needs to be some work done, in my opinion.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. That's Patrick in Merton there. Lots of texts coming in supporting Sophie Ellis-Bextor getting an honour. Let's take a couple more. This is from Kate. The ex-police officer who fought for the Rochford girls, Maggie Oliver, Kate. Yes, I think absolutely she deserves an honour. Roger says, with respect, I don't think you should exclude yourself and all your colleagues on LBC. You, LBC, have entertained me, informed me, and at times challenged my thinking, thus maintaining my interest in current and international affairs. Please don't underestimate your impact on us mere mortals. Well, you see, we're mere mortals as well. Sometimes we do our best to maybe make out that we're more than mere mortals, but we are just the same as anybody else. Claire's in Gloucester. Hello, Claire.
Hello, good morning. How are you doing?
Morning, very well, thank you. What would you like to say?
Good. I think he may already have been offered one and turned it down because he's that sort of guy, but I think Kevin Sinfield, the retired rugby league player who's raised over £11 million for motor neurone disease in memory of his friend, I think it's Ned Burrow, who played with him for Wigan and England. I think he should. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, he ran seven ultramarathons in a week, seven, that's 185 miles in a week. And he did the same in 2020. And he's arranged such a huge amount of money, and he's such a humble guy, and that moment in the London Marathon where he carried Ed, pushed Ed in a wheelchair around the course, and then carried him over the finish line before he died. I just thought that was just incredible, and I think that he should get some sort of award. I don't know which one. I'm not an expert on the honour system.
Well, look, I completely agree with you. I mean, if he doesn't deserve an award, who does?
But there are
so many anomalies in these lists where you have, I mean, Emma Raducanu, I think she got an MBE when she won the US Open Tennis Championship. And I mean, that goes against what I said earlier, that people at the beginning or the middle of their careers shouldn't get honours. But I mean, that was such a real achievement. I don't think anybody would say that she shouldn't have got that. And then you look at Rory McIlroy, for example, who has won all sorts of major championships in the world of golf, won the US Open last year, or this year, sorry. And you think, well, why hasn't he got one? And the papers are speculating it's because HMRC say that they're in a dispute with him over his tax affairs. Well, okay, maybe they are, but why should that detract from his sporting achievement?
It also depends on the popularity of the sport. But I don't think, I mean, I reckon if you ask the England ladies football team and the England ladies rugby team whether it should be them or Kevin Sinfield, I think they'd all say Kevin Sinfield.
Yeah.
Because he's that's of no benefit to him doing that. I mean, he's retired. I mean, I think he's coaching the England defence or something for Union. But he's a retired sportsman. And he achieved a lot as a sportsman as well, but the amount that he has raised for the motor neurone disease. I mean, they've been able to open a whole motor neurone centre. Yeah, you know, the Ned Burrow Centre in wherever they've built it in Wigan or Warrington or somewhere, just with the money that he's raised. And that's just incredible.
Well, I think it is incredible. Anybody who does that sort of fundraising, I think, does deserve public recognition. I think he's had a lot of public recognition, certainly in the media. But that, you kind of, I think we would all feel good if people like him were recognised by the system. And the honours system is all we have to do that. And I think it would be absolutely appropriate for that to happen. Thank you very much indeed, Claire. Louise says, we nominate Nick Abbott. He deserves a knighthood for his bravery, honesty, humour and integrity. Our sole reason for listening to and recommending LBC to our friends. We can't wait for Friday night. Well, you don't have to wait for Friday nights this week. He's on every night. Long may he be on the airwaves. That's Chris in Sevenoaks. Well, and so say all of us. We'll come to more of your calls in a moment with your nominations for the LBC New Year's Honours List. And how do you think the honours system should be reformed? Do you think that the people that are honoured in it, I mean, obviously a lot of them really deserve it. I'm not certainly not saying that they don't. But do you think there does need to be some drastic reform, not just in the names of the different honours either? Because they are redolent of a previous era, aren't they, when a lot of the honours have titles which mention the word empire. Now, I'm not one of these people that is always going to slag off the British Empire. I think the British Empire did a lot of good. There were bad things as well, inevitably. But for 2025, should it not be the Order of British Excellence rather than the Order of the British Empire? 0345 6060 973. Lots of love coming in on the WhatsApp messages for Kevin Sinfield as well. It's 10:31 on LBC News Headlines with Amelia Cox.
Idris Elba, Mira Sayal and co-host of Global's The Sports Agents podcast, Gabby Logan, have been recognised in the New Year's Honours List. Olympic figure skaters Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean have also been made a Dame and Sir. Anthony Joshua is recovering in hospital after he was involved in a car crash in Nigeria. His two friends, who are also part of the boxer's training team, Sina Gami and Latif Ayodele, died in the collision. And a police investigation into a Royal Navy sailor going missing in Gibraltar nearly 40 years ago has ended. Simon Parks was last seen in December 1986 and hadn't returned to HMS Illustrious when it left for Portsmouth. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the south and east with brighter spells developing, a few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
I love visiting Mum and Dad, but as they've gotten older, I've worried about leaving them on their own, especially in winter. We visit as often as we can, but they needed more regular help. That's why we're so grateful to Ellie, their home instead care professional who lives with them and is always there when she's needed. It means Mum and Dad can stay in the home they love, and it gives us peace of mind to know they're okay when we're not there. For award-winning home care you can trust, visit homeinstead.co.uk.
When you buy a BMW approved used electric car, there are no surprises. You'll find the largest range and the widest choice. Naturally, every car has been meticulously checked by qualified BMW technicians. Hardly a plot twist. And they always come with a battery health report and at least 12 months unlimited mileage BMW warranty. Just as you'd expect. BMW approved used electric cars. Nothing new here. Search BMW approved used electric. Obviously.
With Amex Platinum, Laura earns points on...
Can I have the soup and the salad and the tart?
And gets access to the Centurion Airport Lounge too.
Let's have a little relax, a little pudding.
And could use her points to travel for...
Las gambas con mantequilla y...
And that's because with dining, travel and lifestyle benefits, there's always more with Amex Platinum.
Representative 688.5% APR variable. Annual fee. Terms apply. 18 plus. Subject to approval.
As you can hear from my voice, I'm in a state of high exhilaration. Yes, I am positively beside myself. The reason that I can barely contain my enthusiasm is the IKEA Winter Sale. Weeks of incredible bargains. The inexpressible thrill of finding precisely the right thing at the right price. Sail now on. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973.
10:34 on LBC. We're talking about the New Year's Honours List. The headlines on that honours list are that the actor Idris Elba gets a knighthood, Sir Idris, as he will be known in future, and the England women's football coach Serena Wiegmann is made an honorary dame. Now, she's an honorary dame because she's Dutch. So if you are not British, which we're going to be talking about what it means to be British later in the programme, means that she can't actually get an actual damehood, but I think she can still call herself Dame Serena. So, the two questions are, who would you like to nominate for a New Year's Honour on our LBC New Year's Honours list, and how do you think the honours list should be reformed? Will says, has anyone honourable ever received an honour? You're trying to be clever, Will, aren't you? The answer is yes, they have. Edgar says, I'm nominating Bob Mortimer for obvious reasons. I sit opposite Bob Mortimer on the train sometimes because he lives in Tunbridge Wells. But I've never plucked up the courage to say hello. David says, why does Annalise Dodds get a damehood? What for? Why? Just a failed Labour MP. I don't get it. Well, Keir Starmer would have to answer for that one. She was Shadow Chancellor. She got replaced as that. She resigned as International Development Minister. I think she's actually quite a good MP, but does that justify getting a damehood? Well, everyone will draw their own conclusions from that. But often political knighthoods and damehoods, they are a sort of long service award. And certainly in recent years, I must admit, I have questioned some of the knighthoods particularly that have been awarded to male politicians, and indeed some of the damehoods. Obviously, David is questioning that one. Steve says, Sophie Ellis-Baxter is 46, Idris Elba is 53. So I think age has nothing to do with it. Let's go to Richard, who's in Crawley. Hello, Richard.
Oh, good morning. Morning. Nice to speak to you. Not spoken to you before, but I'm phoning up, obviously, to nominate you. And I think Clive Bull as well would be a pretty good nomination. But I was finding out because my father, actually, well, apart from having, with my mother, brought up six children, hopefully successfully, he was the owner of the Cavern Club in Liverpool back in the 50s and 60s and helped launch the career of the Beatles.
Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think he bought the club in 1959, and the Beatles came along as very scruffy kids and kept pestering him for, you know, a slot at his club, which was a jazz club back in the time. But I'd nominate him, because he's my dad, of course, you know.
So, is he still with us?
No, sadly not. No, he succumbed to dementia. Passed away, I think it's 2016 now, so...
And did he often get people getting in touch with him for his memories of that time, for books and things?
Very much so, yeah, very, very much so. And, I mean, you know, this all happened before I was even born, so I know very little about it. But as I say, being the youngest of six, my eldest brother is often contacted, and I think he's been on the odd programme here and there. In fact, he was on... the repair shop, I think last year or the year before, where he brought some of my dad's booking diaries from the cavern.
I don't watch that programme, but I think I did catch that, actually, now you come to mention it. It rings a bell in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've got various years of them, but there was one in particular that I think the programme makers were able to do some work on, and as I say, you know, fix it up for them, for my brother. But my memory of all of that is just, you know, secondhand, because I wasn't even born back at the time. But I'm immensely proud of what he did in terms of, you know, social history, I suppose, or whatever you want to call it. But
well, of course, we shouldn't forget that your father employed Cilla Black as a cloakroom attendant.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yeah. Well, again, secondhand knowledge, but you know, I look through some of the diaries and I see Jerry the Pacemakers. Obviously, the Beatles were there almost day in, day out. I think they were, what he originally did was launch the club for lunchtimes because it was only in the evenings. But the Beatles, as I say, I mean, you know, obviously their manager, Brian Epstein, was responsible for a lot of their work. But I'd like to think that my dad was also instrumental, pardon the pun, in, you know, bringing about the launch of the Beatles, whether you like them or not. They were, you know, fairly significant in their day.
Am I right in thinking that the Cavern Club is still exists, but on a different site?
That's right, yeah. I think part of the problem, and again, you know, I wasn't around at the time, and my dad was a very, very proud man, and I didn't know about any of this until I was a teenager. The club went bust. I think, you know, the likes of the Beatles and whoever else wanted to play there were basically asking too much for their appearances, and he couldn't keep the club going and tried, and unfortunately it didn't work out. And my family lost everything, you know, they lost the roof over their heads and they lost everything that they owned. I like to think that as an unsung hero, if you like, because he's my hero, of course, because he's my dad.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that's a really interesting call, actually, because I think a lot of people think, well, you're nominating him, I mean, obviously, because he is your dad, but some people say, well, people shouldn't get honours for doing their jobs. I mean, like civil servants, for example. You think, well, why should civil servants get all these honours for effectively just doing their job, and yet other people... don't. They have to have gone that extra mile. Now, I'm not suggesting that all civil servants don't go that extra mile. Many of them do. But the fact that if you look through the whole of the honours list, about half of the honours in the honours list go to civil servants. Now, to me, that's just wrong. Yes, if there is a particular civil servant that has really excelled at their job and gone that extra mile and done a brilliant job, absolutely reward them with an honour. But it shouldn't be just because of Buggins' turn, should it?
No, of course, and the thing is, obviously, he's not done what he did for any kind of recognition. That just happened to be, I hate to say it, but, you know, is the right person with the right skills at the right time, I suppose. But nevertheless, you know, his achievement was, well, or part of, you could argue that if it hadn't been him, someone else would have done it, but... he did it, so, you know, I would like to nominate him, because, you know, that's what he did, and he was my dad.
Well, Rebecca has just sent a WhatsApp message saying, oh, wow, are you talking about Brian, the Cabin Club? My mother met Ken Dodd on the stairs there once, and I did a few nights behind the bar in my 20s.
Oh, wow. No, well, my dad's name was Ray.
So it's not Brian. That was a different one.
Brian might have been Brian Epstein. Might have been the Beatles.
Oh yes,
manager.
That's true. Yeah.
No, Ray was the Cavern Club owner. As I say, bought it from a chap called Alan Sittner, I think it was in 1959, and he bought it as a jazz club. And I think the Beatles used to come along and pester him and say, you know, we want to play here. And initially he didn't want them to. He didn't like them because they were quite scuffy. But when he heard them play, I think, using his phrase, I think he was smitten, I think was the word. Absolutely, totally, utterly smitten with them. And as I say, opened up the club to play at lunchtime so that, you know, again, using his phrase, the young kids from Liverpool could come along in their lunch breaks and listen to the Beatles, and, you know, it went from there, really.
Richard, thank you so much for phoning in. Really, really interesting nomination there. Let's go to Paul in Bolton. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Ian. I'm ringing up to say I wouldn't award anyone an honour, but firstly, just before I get into that, I did want to say that it was quite interesting to see Roy Clark on the list, because obviously a lot of the honours have gone to people a little bit more current, and obviously he represents older sitcoms like Last of the Summer Wine. So even though I'm not a fan of the honours system, I did I am a fan of Roy Clark. And also, the other thing I wanted to say, because I just didn't want to forget it as I get into the conversation, is one of my bugbears with the honours system, if we still have to have it, is when someone gets made a sir, then the female partner gets made a lady. But in this day and age where we have a lot of same-sex couples, why is there no honour for the husbands and wives there?
Well, it's interesting you said that, because my partner John said to me once, this was years ago, he said, if you got put in the House of Lords, what would I be? And I said, you would be Mr. John Simmons. And he said, well, that's not fair. I said, no, it isn't, actually. And I think that something should be done about that. But it probably is something that needs to be done by a straight person rather than somebody who's got a bit of self-interest in it. But you're right.
It does need to change because, like I said, I'm not a fan of the honours system, but if you're going to have it, and I did actually try and create one of them petitions, government petitions for it, and nothing came of it in terms of I don't even think it was allowed, or it came to me saying that you had to go to someone else to do that. But I think it's really unequal. But as I say, I'm not for the honours system. I'm all for awards ceremonies, Oscars, BAFTAs, getting awards in your workplace, football, sports personality, all that I'm for. I'm for people getting awards, but I just find that it's very class-ridden, the honours system, and obviously the word empire needs to go, definitely. And if this Labour government can't do it, then future governments, if we go back more to the right, aren't going to do it, are they? And also, as I say, it just makes people think, well, why am I going to work? Why am I going doing a cleaning job? Why am I going doing a bar job and working as hard as ever? Because I'm still seen as inferior because that person's a sir and I'm just Joe Blogs. And I think the titles in particular are the thing for me. But as I say, I think you could create a new sort of honours system without all this pomp and ceremony. And another thing is how much does it cost taxpayers?
Very little.
Does it? Well, that's fair enough. But like you say, I just think we need to move into the 21st century with this, because you think about it, a lot of younger people, they don't watch the BBC the same, or they watch iPlayer, should I say, if they're going to watch it. Are they really going to be bothered about all this in 10, 20 years' time?
I suspect that people would have said that 20 years ago, wouldn't they? I mean, I think this has always been a matter of controversy to an extent. And when you say that you don't want all the pomp and circumstance, what's the point of having it on the system if you don't have a presentation day at the Buckingham Palace or Windsor Castle, and where the King or one of the royal family confers the honour? It's got to be a special occasion, surely.
Well, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I want the honours to be more inclusive, so I want it to be more of an automatic system. Say if there's lots of people who do good work, they automatically get an award, and not necessarily the ceremony at the end of it.
Somebody's got to judge that, haven't they? It can't be automatic.
But that's what I mean, and we see it time and time again, where there must be thousands, even maybe a million plus people today who've done as amazing things as a lot of people on that honours list, and they just haven't been honoured. So, I'm slightly hypocritical, though, because as someone who's LGBT plus, if someone LGBT gets an honour, I'm always a bit pleased in one sense, but that's because of the current climate we live in at the moment, because I just think, oh, that's a little win for our side. But I still don't agree with it deep down, you know what I mean? And I just think it's time to get this modernised once and for all. And
somebody I hope you'll be pleased he's got an honour is Jane O'Zan for her services to the LGBT community. She's sort of has been very high up in the Church of England and has been very outspoken in her views on the church's attitude to these issues. So I was very pleased to see her get an OBE in the honours list. Paul, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to LBC. I'm Ian Dale. It's 10:48.
I'm James O'Brien. Thank you for listening to me on LBC throughout the year.
The independent sentencing review is good enough for everybody else, but what do you use instead?
Personal experience, lived experience. Listen, if they're the facts, they're the facts. But from my lived experience...
They're the facts, but I know better.
They don't understand culture of the UK.
So what is it?
When have I criticised...
Why can't you tell me what it is? You're criticising people who don't know what the culture of the UK is, so you must be able to tell me.
I can't be asked, buddy. Have a good day.
That went well, didn't it, buddy? I'll be back in the new year taking your call on LBC.
From London Gatwick, fly Singapore Airlines to Singapore and beyond. To the beauty of Bali, the warmth of Thailand, and the wonders of Vietnam, or many other Asian destinations. With daily flights and award-winning service, your next adventure starts here. Fares to Thailand starting from £614. Book your escape today at singaporeair.com. Offer ends 26th of January. Terms and conditions apply.
At ulisprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulisprosperity.com.
New year, new you. Maybe. New year, new car. Definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Fonterra Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders until the January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Ian Dale on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
10.50 on LBC, Heather says, I think that the idea of an annual honours list should be continued, but feel strongly that the word empire should be removed, maybe changed to excellence, order of British excellence, or some other phrase. Empire is outdated and has negative connotations. Well, I do think it should be updated, but the word empire, we have been taught by a succession of Marxists that we should be ashamed of the British Empire. And yes, there were bad things that happened in the British Empire, but there was many good things as well. But that is possibly a debate for another day. This is from Shanti, who says, I can't make the head nor tail of where that begins and ends. Oh, no, here it is. Emma Raducanu got an MBE at the age of 19 for winning the US Tennis Championship. Since then, she's not won anything except injuries and pulling out from tournaments. There are so many deserving candidates who work in hospitals that are overlooked, but Emma has been filling her pockets and has done no charity work. All so wrong. Well, that's completely wrong. She does have a charity called the Emma Raducanu Charity Foundation, so let's get that straight. I think that is a difficult one, because the fact that no British woman had won the US Open for, I don't know for how long, but it would have been decades, I think probably did mean that she should get an honour. So it goes against what I said earlier about that people should only get honours at the end of their careers. You look at Virginia Wade, and I think, did she become a dame in the end? She certainly was an OBE for some time. I suppose it depends on sort of what level of honour you think people should actually get. Andrew says, I'd like to nominate Andrew Mountbatten Windsor for services to destroy the monarchy. You're so droll, Andrew. Oh, I can't stop myself laughing at that. Very, very clever. And here's one from Adam, who says, I'd like to nominate my 93-year-old father-in-law, who still works most days in the week as a joiner. Remarkable example to anyone about doing something you love, and it doesn't feel like work. I think that there are many, many people in their 80s and 90s who still do full-time jobs, who go unacknowledged. And I think, Adam, you're absolutely right to nominate your father-in-law, because there are so many people of advancing years who still contribute to society, not necessarily through doing a full-time job, but probably need a little bit more acknowledgement than they get. John is in Cannock. Hello, John.
Morning, how are you doing?
Morning.
The first time I've called, I think, I was just compelled, because it has been a bugbear of mine for about 30 years, to nominate for proper knighthood Daley Thompson. I've never understood for the life of me why he's never had one. I thought it might be behaviour or it might have been refusal, but he's accepted other honours, so it can't be that.
Yeah, I think he's got a CBE, hasn't he?
Yeah, but that's not the same, is it? All these contemporaries, Sebastian Coe and so on, they're all knighted, aren't they? Or at least. And then beyond that, you know, you've got to remember that when he won those successive Commonwealth and World Championships and Olympics, for 7 or 8 years he ruled the hardest sport. He's recognised as the greatest ever athlete we actually had across all disciplines. And I don't see any argument against it. So I've never really understood why he wasn't just propelled straight to that level. And which also... Sorry, go on.
No, I totally agree with you. And let's remind people, he's got 4 world records, or he had, I don't know if they've been broken since, 2 Olympic gold medals, 3 Commonwealth titles, and wins in the World and European Championships. I mean, there aren't many that could compete with that, are there?
Well, there's no one in the UK. I mean, he was an inspiration to that generation. I know a lot of your listeners will be a lot younger than you or I, but for a whole generation of sports people, he was a massive inspiration.
Yeah, totally.
And I think
agree.
He didn't get his first award, I don't think, for a long time, possibly because of the colour of his skin at the time. But that's changed. But he should surely be a knight, you know, if it's good enough for Mo Farah, then it's certainly good enough for Daley Thompson.
Well, I think he does belong in that category with Mo Farah. As you say, you and I grew up with him as a real sporting hero, and I don't know. I mean, look, we aren't party to all of the whys and wherefores of this system, and it isn't really the most transparent system ever. And it may be that there is something there that the Honours Committee say, no, we're not going to do this because there's something that we don't know about. But
well, that would make sense if he had refused the other honours or not been bestowed upon. Yeah. So he's got all the other honours. And that brings me to the other thing, is why is the thing not much more transparent? I mean, I know it's antiquated, but in today's world, couldn't we have a portal where everybody's reasons behind it, proper detailed, you know, not just a few lines? And look at that Baroness, I've forgotten the name now, the Baroness Owen. I mean, I don't suppose you could fill a page of reasons why she was...
Well, you see, that's an interesting one. I was reading a piece a couple of days ago which mentioned her, and she let's remind people, she was the youngest person ever to be put in the House of Lords. She was part of Boris Johnson's resignation honours list. And it got a lot of comment at the time, well, why has he nominated her? Now, you talk to members of the House of Lords on all sides now, and they will say that she has been one of the most sort of well-respected members of the House of Lords, and she actually changed, I can't remember what it was, but she actually changed the law on something this year. So,
well, she must be talented. She must be talented, but my point is we don't really know, do we, properly? And if everybody that was awarded, whether it was people in society or famous people or what looked like cronyism, you could actually, you know, sort some of that out by more disclosure about what were the standard reasons, what were the findings, why, you know, etc.
I think what you couldn't do, you couldn't have, well, these are the reasons we haven't given someone an honour.
No.
I mean, I think that is taking transparency possibly a little bit too far.
Yeah, but you could say they'd refused it, or that they weren't, you know, or that you could answer questions about people's suitability without disclosing the reasons. But it's all just very dark and, you know, mysterious and antiquated, isn't it, as you said.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, John. David says, as an ex-serving soldier, I'm proud to see service personnel receiving royal awards, yet I cannot understand the awarding of actors in that for their contribution to entertainment. Where are those people you've supported more national community projects, homelessness, fostering, community engagement, nuclear programs, renewable energy projects? Focusing on entertainment sends a message that it's not based on national contribution. How many recipients are millionaires, I wonder? Well, actually, comparatively few, I suspect. I think the reason that the media concentrate on celebrities who get honours is because people have heard of them. And, I mean, I've got the Times open in front of me here. There's a double page, and one of the articles on that page is about business people who have received honours. And they say there are actually fewer of them this year than ever, which, to my mind, is ridiculous, because without successful business people, we don't have an economy. So I'd like to see entrepreneurship recognised a lot more than it ever is. But I agree. I think it is sometimes wrong that we should just concentrate on the celebrity names and sports people that are getting honours. And that's why partly I wanted to do this hour, to highlight some other people as well. Right, we'll move on in the next hour because, and I'm just seeing on my switchboard, Constance in Woking has just picked up the phone and she's phoning in. So let's see if we can get her on in the next hour. Even if she wants to talk about honours, we'll continue with that. Now, in the next hour, I want to talk about who is likely to lose their job next year in terms of political party leaders. Because I think we can probably all agree that Nigel Farage is probably safe, that Zach Polanski is probably safe. But what about Keir Starmer, Kemi Badenoch and Sir Ed Davey, or indeed maybe John Swinney? Are they in danger of losing their jobs next year? The consensus seems to be that Keir Starmer certainly is, that Kemi Badenoch, maybe she's recovered her position, but who do you think won't be in a political leadership position in December 2026?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. The New Year's honours list has been revealed and includes actor Idris Elba and figure skaters Jane Torval and Christopher Dean. The winning England women's football and rugby teams were also recognised. CEO of Motherhood, Sandra Igwe, is receiving an MBE for her work supporting the experience of black mothers and those from ethnic minorities. She's told LBC she's proud of how far things have come since she started.
When I first tried to find a support group for black mothers 10 years ago, there was nothing. I could see nothing in the UK, only in the States. And so I'm really proud that the Motherhood Group has been an example of what a good social enterprise looks like that can connect the dots and provide solutions for improvement around maternal health for black mothers.
Anthony Joshua is recovering in hospital after a crash in Nigeria, which killed two members of his team yesterday. Sina Gami and Latif Ayodeli died while travelling in a jeep, which crashed into a stationary truck. The Cabinet Office has been accused of covering up for the royal family after withholding files from the National Archives. Ministers say the documents referring to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's travel plans were never intended to be released. It's emerged a record number of offenders are wearing alcohol tags over Christmas and New Year in England and Wales. They're being used on 4,800 people, either released from prison or serving a community sentence. Justice Secretary David Lammy has told LBC they're proven to cut alcohol-linked crime.
The sad truth is that this type of crime peaks around the festive season, and we're committed to stamping it out. These tags act as a physical and constant reminder to offenders that there's no room for slip-ups. One drink and they could find themselves back in court or even behind bars.
And Marks and Spencer has announced it's introducing a range of meals and snacks for those on weight loss medication. The supermarket says they're designed for people with a lower appetite to maintain a healthy diet. Recent figures suggest that sales of the jabs in July rose by almost 500,000 compared to the same month the previous year. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 37 points at 99.04. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the south and east with brighter spells developing. A few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good morning. It's 3 minutes past 11 on LBC. It's Ian Dale here with you, sitting in for James O'Brien until 1 o'clock. Just one text that I didn't read out in the last hour, but I think I should. It's from Mary Rose, who says, Samir Zitouni, the rail worker, should receive recognition for his courage and selflessness in saving the lives of many people during the knife attack on the LNER train in November. A very brave person indeed. You're absolutely right, Mary Rose. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. I think the reason that he wouldn't have been included in this honours list is because it would have probably already been finalised in November. I think that's a bit silly. I think you should be able to add people in later on, but I very much hope that he will be included in the next New Year's honours list. Now, let's talk about politics in the next hour, because as this is New Year's Eve, why not look forward to 2026? Because the one thing we can be sure of is that politics is going to be equally as interesting in 2026 as it has been in 2025. I don't think anybody would have thought at the beginning of 2025 that Keir Starmer's position as leader of the Labour Party and Prime Minister would be under threat by the end of the year. But you don't have to be a professional political commentator to work out that Keir Starmer is in, well, deep doo-doo, as George Bush might have once said. His position is being questioned, not just by the usual sort of political commentators and pundits, but by people within his own party. And not just being questioned, but people are saying that they think it's inevitable that by the end of 2026, he won't be leader of the Labour Party and won't be our Prime Minister. I'm not sure I subscribe to that point of view, for several reasons. Partly because I think that the Labour Party doesn't conduct regicide in the same way that the Conservative Party does. And one of the lessons, surely, that the Labour Party should learn from the Conservative experience of the last few years is that changing the leader does not necessarily improve things. You have to change the substance of what you're doing. You have to show people that you know which direction you're going in. You need to explain what your values are, where you're heading, how you're going to get to the sunlit uplands. And Keir Starmer has never been able to do that. Partly because I think, in many ways, understandably, they were so obsessed about winning the election that they forgot to do the planning for government. And that even though they had a manifesto, they didn't really have an idea as to how they would implement it. They don't seem to have an idea of how to run a successful economy. And I'm not saying that the Conservatives were any better. I'm genuinely not. But I think Keir Starmer is in a very, very difficult position as we have this conversation today. And when you look at the latest odds from Ladbrokes, they just sent me an email this morning. They're saying that both he and Kemi Badenoch are 7-4 on to lose their jobs over the next 12 months. So this is not intended to be a let's have a go at Keir Starmer hour. It's meant to enable you to say which of the party leaders you think are most in danger this year of being toppled. And what you think would be the consequence of that. So I've outlined Keir Starmer's troubles, and I mean they're exacerbated today because Sharon Graham, who's the leader of Unite, which is Labour's biggest donor, she says that the party has become austerity light under Keir Starmer's leadership. She thinks it's inevitable, her word, not mine, that Sir Keir Starmer will be replaced as Labour leader over the course of the next 12 months. She's written an article for The Times where she says that the government risks sowing the seeds of its own destruction if Starmer's successor in Downing Street does not depart from its current path. Denouncing Labour's agenda as rudderless and austerity light, she urges ministers to increase borrowing for investment, introduce a wealth tax, ditch its net zero policies, and use increased defence budgets to buy more weapons from British arms manufacturers. Well, I agree with her on the last one, not so much the others. Do you agree with that analysis? But what would really change? And what would really change, say, if Andy Burnham became leader, or Wes Streeting became leader, or Angela Rayner, or any number of others took over? Shabana Mahmood is the latest name being mentioned. A change of personnel does not automatically mean a change in fortune, does it? If you're a Labour supporter, are you frustrated by all of this talk of a leadership change? 0345 6060 973. Let's turn our attention to the Conservative Party. Kemi Badenoch was elected leader of the Conservative Party at the beginning of November 2024, so she's been there for nearly 14 months now. Within 3 months, people were questioning as to whether she was the right leader to revive the Conservative Party fortunes. It's fair to say that up until, I would say, August, September time, she had a pretty tricky time. She had announced very few new policies. Her view was that, well, let's show people that we are regretful of a lot of the things that the last government did. But, of course, she was a cabinet minister in the last Conservative government for the last several years of it. So she couldn't say that she was a completely new broom because she was in the cabinet before. And yet something happened in August, September time that seemed to turn a switch. She'd started to perform really well in Prime Minister's questions. She did a really good party conference speech, which seemed to acknowledge the difficulties the party was in. She then gave an absolutely coruscating performance in the budget debate. Rachel Reeves had delivered her budget, and she absolutely laid into it in one of the most aggressive political speeches I think I've seen in years. And the person who normally sits in this chair, James O'Brien, I think he said that day that he thought that was her finest hour. It was very personal, it has to be said, but politics is often very personal. So has she saved herself from a leadership challenge this year? I can't say hand on heart that I think she has, because the May elections are going to be dreadful for both Labour and the Conservatives. At least that's how it looks at the moment. So I'm not sure that she's out of the woods. She certainly needs to build on her performances over the past 2 or 3 months. Let's turn our attention to Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, who got more seats than any other Liberal leader going back to the days of Asquith and Lloyd George. They have 72 MPs now. But what has he actually done since the election to enhance the position of the Liberal Democrats? The latest poll shows them around 10-12%. Now, that is not going to enable them to increase their number of seats, all other things being equal, at the next election. There's growing disquiet, I'm told, within the Liberal Democrats about Ed Davey's leadership. They don't think he's got the oomph. He can't possibly repeat all the stunts that he did last time. I think people would ridicule that if he did. But there doesn't seem to be any great fire in his belly now. And a lot of Liberal Democrats are getting very dissatisfied with that. I'll leave Nigel Farage out of this. I'll leave Zach Polanski out of this, because Zach Polanski is certainly new in the job. He's increased the Green Party's ratings to somewhere in the upper teens, which I think even he wouldn't have thought he would be able to achieve in such a short time. And Nigel Farage, there's no way that he's going to be toppled anytime soon. So let's leave those two out of the debate at the moment. We could bring in this new Your Party into the debate. I'm later today, I'm going to publish on my Substack my predictions for 2026, one of which is that Jeremy Corbyn will resign from Your Party during 2026. But they haven't actually got a leader. They're going to have a collective leadership, so we can leave them out of the equation as well. You look at John Swinney, leader of the SNP, not the most charismatic character, but he's steadied the ship since he took over from Humza Yousaf. I suspect that the SNP are probably going to do better than expected in the May elections in Scotland, but will that be enough to save him? Maybe he'll think, well, I've had a good innings, this is my second leadership of the SNP, time for a new broom. Stephen Flynn is the one that is now tipped to take over from John Swinney, so be interested in your views on him. 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. Which of our party leaders do you think are still going to be in their current positions at the end of December 2026? And what does it depend on? Let's go to Awad, who is in Barnet. Awad, hi.
Hi, Ian. I hope you've had a good morning, first of all. I personally think Kelly Badenoch is actually secure in her position. I don't think she will be toppled in 2026. I think Keir Starmer's in real trouble from the left flank of his party. I think Ed Davey will most likely be fine, mostly because I don't see anyone else from the Liberal Democrats who really catches my eye or has a different vision to me. And I think the SNP will be secure for now. It all depends on the May elections, but there doesn't, the current forecast has them you know, taking over from disaffected Labour voters who Labour voters.
There was a poll out this morning in Scotland that showed the SNP on 32%, Reform, I think, on 20%, and both Labour and the Conservatives on 10%, which, I mean, when you think that Anas Sawa, the Scottish Labour leader, looked as if he would be taking over from the SNP in government in these elections only, what, less than a year ago, I mean, that is quite phenomenal.
Yeah, I think there is very much several elements to it. I think if you look at the Red Wall and if you look at Scotland, there are certain aspects that overlap. There is a certain working class community in Scotland similar to the Red Wall who are socially conservative in their values and fiscally liberal or fiscally left wing, and those people tend to be picked up by Reform from both the Conservatives and from Labour. And now that ends up splitting the vote. So even though the SNP wouldn't have an overall majority in terms of the overall vote, that splitting of the vote between several different parties, I think, is actually to the advantage of the SNP. And I think appealing to many people in Scotland who don't like the way the country is going and feel a sense of Scottish identity but feel alarmed by Reform's rhetoric, I think is going to be to the benefit of the SNP.
Michelle has just sent a text saying that you sound like Kemi, or what?
So here's an interesting thing. I switched from the Labour Party to the Conservative Party recently.
Why?
So several aspects. I feel like Kemi gave an authentic vision, and sorry that I'm slurring my words, but she gave her authentic self, in which a way I think to some degree Farage does, but I'm very much alienated from Farage, and in a way that I don't believe Keir Starmer is, and I'm socially conservative in some of my values. I'm also fiscally conservative, but I consider myself to be on the centre of the Conservative Party. There's also...
Were you ever in the Labour Party in that case?
I've changed my views recently. I used to be a die-hard lefty up until recently, where I fell out of the Labour Party from the left flank. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to read the Conservative manifesto from last year, and I'm going to read their current policy proposals. It's sort of half-heartedly, and I started to nod my head. I think, you know, we need responsible controls on immigration. I think Keir Starmer to some degree agrees with that, but the issue is his party's not going to let him. A lot of the left flank elected in 2017 and 2019, who, you know, were selected on their basis, some of whom were selected on their basis on friendliness to Corbyn and his policies. I'm not saying that's for all of the 2019 intake and the 2017 intake, but there is an element of that. I believe.
Okay. Oh, a very interesting call. Thank you very much indeed. Let's take a couple of texts here. David says, Zach Polanski doesn't seem to say much about green things. It's all schoolboy Marxism. Well, I think that is an accusation that can fairly be levelled at him. Simon says, what about Wales? Labour will be hammered. Well, that may well be the case. Plaid Cymru seem to be leading in the polls at the moment, and Reform are in second place. It's possible that those two positions could switch round. But, I mean, the fact that Labour is polling so badly in Scotland and Wales says an awful lot. I think it's almost, judging by the opinion polls, it's almost inconceivable that Labour could form the next government in Cardiff. But stranger things have happened. I mean, these elections are still, just over 4 months away. So a lot of water can flow under the bridge in the meantime. Mike says, Ian, I bumped into my Conservative MP on Saturday. I pointed out how I'd seen a marked improvement in Miss Badenoch over the past few months. He was eager to point out that it would likely coincide with when he became a PPS. I don't know who Kevin Badenoch's PPS is. I'm going to look that up in a moment. Roddy points out that that Stephen Flynn isn't a Scottish MSP. Well, that is true, but he is standing to be an MSP in the May elections. And he certainly has the highest profile of any other SNP politician, I think. John Glenn, apparently, is Kemi Badenoch's PPS. So there we are. Mystery solved. 18 minutes past 11.
This is LBC.
Relax and let Lidl make it a New Year's to savour. Get 15% off deluxe chilled party food, like golden prawn toasties with ponzu dip, scrumptious paella bites and delicious vegetable dim sum. Party nibbles? Sorted. 18 plus GB only, subject to availability. Selected stores, terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LBTV. Ends 31st of the 12th.
So, close your eyes. Picture the scene. Just you and me, alone, enjoying breakfast on our own little island. Sounds perfect, right?
Yeah.
Great, because I've booked Wickes to design our new kitchen.
At Wickes, we have over 80 kitchen styles to choose from, with prices from under £3,000. And, right now, find big savings in the Wickes kitchen sale. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Terms apply.
The following is from TfL.
My name was Luna, like the moon. I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He'd had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
The Hilton sale is now on, and thankfully it doesn't sound like this. Instead, our sale sounds a bit more like this.
Welcome back.
With a warm welcome, spacious rooms, central locations, and up to 20% off your stay. You can swap chaos for comfort this winter. Book now at Hilton.com. Hilton, for the stay. Offer subject to availability across participating hotels. Terms and conditions apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060973.
20 past 11. Why is Keir Starmer in particular in such trouble, do you think? A lot of people have the theory that Labour, although they won a massive majority in the election, they spent so long on winning that majority, they didn't spend enough time on planning what they would do in government. Now, look, every government makes has successes, every government has failures, every government makes mistakes. But we are now, 17 months into this Labour government. I'm completely bewildered as to why Keir Starmer has made so many unforced errors. In the end, the buck does stop with him. You can't constantly blame your advisers. He's got rid of most of his initial advisers. He's shown no great loyalty to most people in his administration, except for Morgan McSweeney. But I think that would be one prediction I might well make, that by the end of the year, even if Keir Starmer isn't gone, Morgan McSweeney might well be. He seems to be his most trusted advisor. And if he went, I think that would put a lot of question marks over Keir Starmer. Now, Sharon Graham, she is the very fiery leader of the Unite Union. She's had a right old go at Keir Starmer in the Times today. And you can't just dismiss her because she's a left-wing union leader. They are Labour's biggest donor. And if Unite decided to withdraw their money from Labour, that would be a real crisis for the party. So why do you think Keir Starmer is in such trouble? And do you think he will still be Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party by the end of 2026? Anthony is in Ashford. Hello, Anthony.
Hi, good morning, Ian. Yes. Hi. I'll just go through the three, if you don't mind. I'll start with Ed Davey. I think he's going to be there in a year's time in his budgie smugglers, because he's worked out a kind of formula, hasn't he? He just does a stunt, and that really covers everything. I wish it would cover more of him.
Yes, but I don't. That can't be for the long term. It was very successful during the last election, but lightning doesn't strike twice. And I think he's got to come up with something a little bit better than that.
Well, it's only a little bit long to see for those stunts, you know, unless he sort of loses a lot of weight or something. So I won't be personal, but
you won't be personal, but you'll make a comment on his weight. Okay.
Well, exactly. Kemi has obviously had Maggie Thatcher lessons, hasn't she, at PMQs. But we saw that with William Hague, having word-perfect PMQs doesn't get you to be PM. I think she'll still be there in a year's time. She's also worked out a formula to be sort of feisty at PMQs, keep the backbenchers pleased, and hope for some good results in the local elections. I don't think they're going to get them. And Keir Starmer, I think he will also be there. Some people will be groaning in a year's time, including most of his MPs, but he has got to absolutely stick to the centre grounds, because that's where the next general election is going to be won. It's not going to be won on the far right with Farage, nor with so-called Your Party at those two polls. That ground is going to be fought for once again, as it was with Cameron, to an extent with Boris, not with May because she kind of lost. But that is the only place where, to date, most governments have won.
Well, that's what I've always said, that you can only win an election from the centre ground. A lot of people, they disagree with that now. They say, well, look at other countries. That's not the case. You can win elections now from the right or from the left. I mean, you look at what happened in Argentina, where Javier Milei won from the, well, hard right. He's, believe it or not, he's coming on a state visit to this country, I think in April. And Kemi Badenoch is a big fan of his, a lot of his economic reforms. And it is true to say that in some ways he's turned around the country. And I think he's incredibly popular there, unless someone wants to ring in and tell me completely the opposite. I don't know. I mean, I would be very uncomfortable if the Conservative Party decided to just adopt a sort of reform-light policy programme. I don't think that will get them anywhere at all, because they would lose even more people from the other end of the party to the Liberal Democrats.
Well, exactly. But going back to something you just don't mind, one thing his one card he holds is a majority. And don't forget that May clung on, you know, without a majority to the bitter end. Boris had a majority but threw that away. That is the one card I think he's got to play. And the other card is I think he's going to have a pretty massive next reshuffle. And the scapegoat is going to be Rachel Reeves, because the economy is in a strange position at the moment. We're not in recession, haven't been really for quite some time. As long as we stay there, I think he's safe. If we plunge into some great deep recession, then I think he is in danger.
Well, I think any prime minister who's presiding over a recession is almost by definition in danger, because if the economy isn't performing, if people don't feel better off, if unemployment is rising, if inflation is still a problem, then clearly the economy will have a lot of issues. Anthony, thank you. Nadia has a view on this. She says, I'm really frustrated with people talking against Keir Starmer, looking inward instead of looking out and supporting their leader. People just have unrealistic expectations. They want so much, but do not want to pay more tax, which does leave the finances in a difficult position. But I think more importantly, journalists like Chris Giles in the FT, they say there are green shoots. The PMI says private sector confidence is up. We're out here, don't hear much positive in the media. The print media, pundits and most presenters are against them, so they need to grab the media agenda and talk directly to the public. It was discussed on Henry's show. I think the country had sadly taken a lurch to the right. Well, it is often said that politicians always blame, or people who are dissatisfied with a political leader always blame the media, that we're the ones that, well, we say negative things about politicians and therefore people lose trust in them. I think when you look at the record so far of this government and say, well, have you really seen any meaningful change, any positive change? Has the economy grown in the way that they promised it would? Well, you'd have to say no on both counts. And that's not me being sort of a partisan Tory. That is me just sort of stating facts. I don't think anybody could really say that the economy is in a great state at the moment. Now, they could equally say, well, we've only had 17 months, give us time. But they've broken so many promises on the economy, not to put up taxes, not to put up national insurance. They seem to have no clue what it means to actually have an entrepreneurial economic policy. 0345 6060 973 is the number to call. But I'm not just talking about Keir Starmer here, because the positions of both Ed Davey and Kemi Badenoch are being questioned too. So let's not leave them out of the discussion. Does anyone out there think that Keir Starmer will actually survive next year as leader? 0345 6060 973. Let's go to Tony in Greenock. Hello, Tony.
Morning, Ian. My pleasure to speak to you.
Now, I never know. Is it Greenock or Greenock?
It's Greenock, Ian.
Is it Greenock? Yes. I knew I'd get it wrong.
No, it's fine. It's a common mistake.
Okay, what would you like to say?
Yeah, I'm coming at this from a Scottish perspective. I think the SNP, if the numbers play out, will do rather well in May, the May elections. I think it's more to do with the fact that Labour and the Conservatives are imploding up here on the back of the government and the opposition down in London, more than anything that John Swinney and his team are doing. I mean, there are some notable things that they have done, but there are some notable things that they have messed up quite royally. And there's a bit of disappointment around the progress that they've made for the number of years they've been in power. But I do think their central message still resonates with a lot of people around independence and cutting the ties with the government in London. The worry for me is around reform. It seems to be getting a lot of traction up here as well. I was very surprised to see Malcolm Offord jump ship to reform.
We should explain. He was a Conservative peer. He was a minister in the Sunak government.
Yes, and he was a Conservative appointee to the House of Lords, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I'm surprised by that, but. There's different opinions going around as to why that has happened, but it just plays into this narrative that reform are on the up in Scotland.
I
hope that's not. Yeah, I know, but I just hope it's not reflected at the ballot box, because I don't really understand the basic premise of reform is around stopping the boats and immigration and what have you. I don't think there's much. Value beneath that for them. They can't seem to answer any questions below that. So for me, the SNP will do well.
But surely the reason for their rise, whether it's in the whole of the United Kingdom or Scotland, is it's because they have become the party for the protest vote. The Liberal Democrats used to be that party back in the day, in the 1980s, 1990s, and reform have inherited that mantle. And there are a lot of people who are saying they'll vote reform, not because they particularly believe in any reform policies, not particularly because they may like Nigel Farage. It's the equivalent of the none of the above box, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a shame that they step into that void with that. But I do think there's an awful lot, probably Tory voters are moving towards reform in Scotland. If you see the numbers of Tory, the predictions of the numbers of the Tories up here, it's falling away rather dramatically, and it coincides with the rise in the number of people who are intending to vote for reform. So I think there's a correlation there. On the SNP, I do think that your man Stephen, what's his name? Stephen Flynn will eventually accede to the throne. I think it will be a gradual process. He'll probably win a seat in May, become an MSP, and he is seen as the heir apparent up here. He's a very able politician, seems to do very well down in London. So, that's what we need up here is able politicians who are capable of making the change and delivering on the promises.
He might not like this description, but he's got a touch of the Alex Salmons about him. He's a very good speaker. He's almost inspirational. He's got a great sense of humour. I think he relates to people in a way that possibly John Swinney and Nicola Sturgeon never have or never did.
Yeah, I would agree. Plus, he's a Dundee United fan, which gets my vote. So, I think that's the way it's going to go. As for Starmer, I think he might hang on. It's like turning around a super tanker, I think, the economy here. And that's the message that needs to be passed across, is this is not going to sort itself out in 18 months, 2 years' time. The problems that have been inherited will take a number of years to rectify, and as long as the narrative or the numbers show that it's moving in the right direction, Starmer can build on that. But I do think there'll be one or two big names kicked out of his it's what you cabinet in the next
he had the opportunity to do that when he kicked Lucy Powell out. Now that rather rebounded on him, given that she's now the deputy leader. But she was the only real casualty. Even Ian Murray, the Scottish secretary, he got rid of him and then brought him back in a more junior position, which I thought was a very odd thing to do. So it was a cabinet reshuffle that didn't really merit the name. Thank you very much indeed, Tony. Nick says, purposely selected partial facts, Ian. Get it right. Well, Nick, give me a call and give me some other facts then. I've always said that I think Keir Starmer has done quite well on the foreign front, but foreign policy doesn't really win or lose many votes, does it? I think the Chagos deal was terrible, but apart from that, I think he's performed well on the international stage. More of your calls in a moment. 11:33 on LBC News Headlines with Amelia Cox.
More than 1,000 people have been named on the New Year's honours list, including Idris Elba and Torvalyn Dean. Co-host of Global's The Sports Agents podcast, Gabby Logan, says she's absolutely thrilled to be receiving an OBE. Ukrainian officials are warning allies to ignore Russia's accusation that Kyiv launched a drone strike on Vladimir Putin's home. They say the Kremlin has provided no proof that such an attack even took place. And a problem with the overhead power supply in the Channel Tunnel is causing disruption to Eurostar and Eurotunnel services. Passengers heading to France are being advised to postpone their journeys to a different date, with delays and cancellations likely. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the southeast with brighter spells developing, a few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees.
This is LBC.
Brighten your January with the Big Hendy Sale. Get up to £1,000 off selected used vehicles across every dealership and brand in the fantastic Hendy range. From sporty to spacious, from petrol to hybrid and all-electric powertrains, we've got a vehicle to match every style and budget. Don't miss out. These offers won't last forever. Head down to your nearest Hendy dealership today and drive into the new year with incredible value and a car you'll love. Offer on used vehicles only. T's and C's apply.
Have you noticed the way fans shout at football matches?
Oh, wake up!
That's because conveying your message with sound is the most effective way to communicate to the players on the pitch that they're rubbish. And this works in advertising too. You see, research shows how brands that use radio to amplify their advertising are 49% more likely to get noticed. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Stop Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar, Rowing Boats, Aldous Blaze, Meerkats, Honey Pot, Bears. Kids, put on your swimmers for Jungle Splash.
Yeah, let's go, Mum.
Right. Cannon Arena, Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom, Go-Karts, Wave Runner 2, Magical Wood and Cafe.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
Hi, I'm Andrew from New Zealand and Australia travel specialist, Travel Essence. For a tailor-made holiday unlike any other, find your way to us. Our local knowledge saves you time and money, and our experience is your guarantee of quality. We are also members of ABTA and ATOL. Amazing journeys down under start at travelessence.co.uk.
Ian Dale on LBC. Text 84850.
11:36. Does Keir Starmer really deserve to be in such political trouble? Because I think even his closest allies recognise that he is in quite a perilous position. And it's not just me saying that, it's his own politicians, his own MPs are saying that. Some of them are saying it openly. Often in these situations, you get people whispering behind sort of closed doors into the ears of journalists, off the record, of course, about what they think of their political leaders. But here, you've got several Labour MPs who've gone public and said, well, he's got until the May elections. If he doesn't ship up by then, he can ship out. It's quite astonishing that people are saying that openly. It shows that they have no fear. And that is a dangerous position for any political leader to be in. And we've seen that with Conservative leaders over the past few years. But why don't these people learn the lesson from the Conservative years that if you just keep changing your leader, you lose the total respect of the electorate. It doesn't necessarily improve things. when Theresa May was ousted in, or when she resigned and Boris Johnson took over. Yes, he then did win an election with a big majority, but did things really improve for the Conservative Party markedly after that? Then we had Liz Truss, then we had Rishi Sunak. And I just wonder whether people look at that and think, oh, well, that was the Conservative Party, that's different. We're Labour, we don't act in this way. If we get rid of Keir Starmer, there'll be a really good reason for it, and we'll have a ready-made alternative. But it's not so simple, is it? Because the Labour Party have never been very good at regiciding their leaders. Sorry, I turned a noun into a verb there, didn't I? Terrible. But maybe they think that that's the only way that many of them are going to win their seats at the next election. And that is what it comes down to. If Labour MPs come to the conclusion that Keir Starmer can't win the next election, then if they don't act, they might as well give up now. That's what a lot of them think. And it's a pretty major thing for an MP to go into an election knowing that they're going to lose. And if you look at the majorities of a lot of Labour MPs, that they're not big. They're not big majorities. And so if Keir Starmer's personal poll ratings still flounder along at sort of minus 55%, the lowest of any Prime Minister at this stage in the Parliament in history, if those poll ratings don't improve fairly soon, you can understand why they will get nervous. What do you think Keir Starmer's biggest miscalculations have been? And what about Kemi Badenoch's position? Because I don't think anyone would say that she's totally out of the woods, even though she's had a good few months. She has announced policies now, which she wasn't intending to do, but she's seen the rise of reform, and she's come to the conclusion the only way to beat reform is to come up with policies which show that the Conservative Party is about substance and that reform are about knee-jerking. I mean, it's a crude way of putting it, but I think that is the Conservative strategy now, to try and convince people that they're a very different Conservative Party, that they're not just about trying to be reform-light, they're not going to just chase reform votes. Because to my mind, the people that have defected from the Conservatives to reform, they've gone. They're not coming back anytime soon. A few of them on the margins might. But I think all Kemi Badenoch can do is to try and persuade people to actually give her a second look, or maybe even a first look. And the evidence so far, certainly in the last few weeks, is that I think people are starting to do that. But I say starting because if you look at their polling position, they're now around 19, 20%. They were 15, 16, 17%. So there has been a little bit of an improvement. But you can't really win an election from that position. 0345 6060 973. And let's also not exclude Ed Davey from this conversation, because there are people within the Liberal Democrats who are questioning his leadership. Why do you think that is? This is from Andrew, who says it's all about the economy. If the economy was flying, the PM would not have the problems he has, but he's been guided economically by a Chancellor who's out of her depth. If a CEO of a company had a finance director who had profoundly damaged the growth of the business, putting the business at risk of potential bailout, if growth continues to flounder, they would be gone. So Keir will be gone unless he deals with the problem, and he will definitely be gone if he doesn't. Well, the one thing that you can say about Keir Starmer is that he has been quite ruthless on occasion with people that he doesn't feel are performing. I mean, Sue Gray was, I suppose, the obvious example of that. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that he could do what you suggest, Andrew. But I would suggest to you that he's so tied in with Rachel Reeves that if he did do that, it would threaten his own position as well. Because Rachel Reeves, believe it or not, has a lot of support within the Parliamentary Labour Party. They like her. Because although this doesn't necessarily come through in television and radio interviews, she's actually a very likeable person, and that does count for something in politics, even now. Norman's in Epsom. Hello, Norman.
Hello, Ian.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I think Starmer will survive another year, but he needs to learn from the last 18 months, and I think the first thing he needs to do is improve his outlook and the way he comes across to people. He doesn't seem to have much of a sense of humour that he can display in public. And I think that Badenoch and her team have learnt from this, and I think they've employed now a new set of comic writers to aid her PMQ performances, whereas before I think she may have written her own PMQ questions and approach. I think now she seems to have being guided by people that have injected a lot of humour into her style, knowing that Starmer can't respond in a humorous comic way because he doesn't have that natural timing. So she can use the lines she's been given, knowing that he can't respond on his feet in a humorous way. And I think that's why her performances in Parliament seem to have improved. I think that's something he needs to learn from.
I think that is part of it. I think she does have new people advising her. What I haven't worked out yet is how many of the lines that she delivers are actually pre-prepared, because a lot of them, you think, well, that can't have been pre-prepared. I wonder how much also is, and I've said this to one or two of her advisors in the past, I said, you've got to let Kemi be Kemi. And I think that's part of what's happened, in that she has almost got trust in herself to do what she's done. And I'm sure there will be occasions when it doesn't work. But yeah, when she was first elected leader, I thought that it was going to be absolute box office to see her up against Keir Starmer at PMQs. Now, it didn't turn out like that until, I would say, a few months ago. And I think that is in part because she's got the confidence now to be herself.
Yeah, the attack on Rachel Reeves is what they put her in there to do. That's what she was elected to do. That's what they were wanting from her, well, to go on the attack.
It is the role of a leader of the opposition to do that, isn't it?
But she did it in a, not just attacking the political aspect, but almost a personal attack. And I think that's what Kemi, that's her natural, that's what she feels comfortable. She will go after the person. She'll play the person as opposed to the ball at the same time. I think Starmer will survive. I don't see anyone really threatening him. Whether he can he deselect Rachel Reeves, I think the time will come, in the same way Thatcher got rid of Geoffrey Howe. They seem to be part of a partnership in the beginning, but eventually she changed her chancellor to Nigel Lawson.
Yeah.
So it can happen. It's whether whoever he puts in to if he puts someone in to replace Rachel Reeves, I have no idea who that would be. Whether it could be, Wes Streeting, because he needs, if he wants to be Labour leader, he needs to keep climate. I think that leaders should have experience in those very front rank roles, and I think that would be a natural next step for him to go on to be Chancellor before he becomes leader of the Labour Party, whether in opposition or in as PM.
Well, if he does replace her, I suspect it wouldn't be Wes Streeting. I suspect it would be Pat McFadden, because he's regarded as a safe pair of hands. But who knows? Norman, thank you very much indeed. John says, the right are definitely being helped towards power by a media that refuses to talk about Reform's myriad of scandals and problems that would never be off the agenda if they were happening on the left. John, I don't know what media you're watching or listening to, but I don't recognise that characterisation at all. Whenever there's a Reform scandal, we devote hours to it on LBC, just as other media outlets do. In fact, Reform always think they get an unfair crack of the whip from the media. So just shows one person. I mean, I always find this doing my evening programme, and I'm sure James has the same on this programme, that sometimes you say something which you think is perfectly clear, and it's totally misinterpreted by people who are listening, and they interpret it in four different ways. Never understood that phenomenon, but there we are. That's what we do. We'll take more of your calls in a minute on the future of the three main party leaders in 2026. Do they have one? It's 11:46.
I'm Tom Swarbrick. Thank you for your calls throughout the year on LBC.
Because our young girls approach these foreign guys.
So it's up to the girls to not approach people who they think might be foreign. What is that girl meant to... No, don't laugh, you despicable man. Why are you blaming a 15-year-old girl? Living as a woman doesn't make you a woman.
I trust people to be an expert in their own gender. If someone has been living as a woman for 15 years...
What does that mean, living as a woman?
I don't really know how I can answer the question again.
It's not about timeline.
Because
it's
you not said about 90 calendar. Days, Mr. Hooker. The president said 90 days.
Don't let me answer the question and don't interrupt me.
I'll choose when I speak. Please carry on.
Then this interview is terminated.
I'll be back in the new year taking your calls on LBC. Did you know Vets for Pets are
the nation's most trusted vets?
We think that's because they're
locally owned
and locally loved.
Wherever you are,
We've got a vet local to you.
Vets for Pets. We're all for pets. Based on a survey. To verify, search vetsforpets.com/allforpets.
EasyJet's Big Orange Sale is now on. Beat the blues and book the beach with up to £400 off package holidays and up to 20% off flights. EasyJet, get out there. Selected dates and flights. Flight sale ends 3rd of Feb. Holiday sale ends 3rd of March. Min spend and ATL protected. T's and C's apply.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. R, rest every 2 hours too. I, inspect all your pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Now, I'm as guilty as anyone when it comes to ignoring things. Rogue grey hairs, red flags in relationships, or that service reminder on your car dash. Luckily, that one's easy. Visit Cinch for fat-free servicing at over 100 locations. Any car, whether you bought it from Cinch or not. With MOTs, $39.95 and servicing from only $129.95. To book your service or buy your next car, visit cinch.co.uk. See cinch.co.uk/servicing for details, terms and exclusions apply.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:49, Beatrice says, I'm hugely frustrated by the talk of Labour leadership, especially all the gotcha media questions. Like what? And the Morgan McSweeney briefing against cabinet ministers. This is as well as West Streeting and Andy Burnham being on manoeuvres. They should rally around Starmer and help him be better. He's a decent but unpolitical man who could be better with support rather than infighting. I think you're absolutely bang on Andy Burnham. He's made his ambitions, there's no secret about his ambitions. West Streeting, I think, is a slightly different case because I think I see little evidence of him being on the same kind of manoeuvres as Andy Burnham. But I think where you do have a really good point, Beatrice, is when you say that Keir Starmer is a decent but unpolitical man. The fact that he has only been an MP since 2015, he was on the front bench, I think, within a year, and then got the leadership after only 5 years of being an MP. I'm not sure that's done him any favours, because he's not somebody who's grown up within the Labour Party. I'm not sure he even understands the Labour Party in the way that most Labour leaders have done in the past, and I think that's to his disadvantage. He's not used to the machinations of Westminster, and although he can be ruthless at times, he probably hasn't been ruthless when he needed to be ruthless. And I think that is part of the reason why he's in such political trouble at the moment. I'm not even sure he recognises that he's in such political trouble, because he doesn't have a coterie of close political friends who are willing to speak truth to power. I think Morgan McSweeney is probably his closest ally. But when you look round that cabinet table, and you think, which of those cabinet ministers would die in a ditch for him? I'm not sure you'd have a very long list. I would have said Bridget Phillipson. But then, of course, he asked her to run for the deputy leadership, knowing, or, well, of course he couldn't have known, I suppose, but suspecting that she wouldn't win. So he's got a real track record of throwing close allies under the bus. And people remember that sort of thing. George is in Wimbledon. Hello, George.
Ian, hello. It's lovely to talk to you.
Hi.
Always been a fan.
Thank you very much. What would you like to say?
I think there's a reason why he only got 33% is because he is apolitical. I don't think he's ever shown any political soul. I don't think he's ever shown any clear purpose. He's like an empty vessel. And I think with the Tories being so hated last year, to only get 33% of the vote, of those who went out to vote, it tells you everything about the man. And I think that was seen in his first hurdle where he fell, this $5 billion he was trying to get from the winter fuel allowance, and he failed at that first hurdle. And I think that set the whole of his premiership in sail then. The tail's wagging the dog, and it continues to do so.
Good. You see, that I think you're right. I think that and the Freebiegate scandal, I think almost sort of, I mean, it sent out completely the wrong message and got people offside right from the beginning. But the winter fuel allowance thing, I mean, that could easily have been avoided, because what Rachel Reeves and he have fallen for are Treasury proposals that they tried to get through many Conservative chancellors. George Osborne has been very good on this on his podcast Political Currency with Ed Balls, where he's listed all the things that Rachel Reeves has done, well, some things that Rachel Reeves has done. He said, well, they kept suggesting that when I was Chancellor to put in my budgets, but I could see the political downsides of doing that, so I never did it. And unfortunately, Rachel Reeves has done all of those things. You can't just blame Keir Starmer for this. It has to be fall at her door as well.
I agree with you entirely. And I think that goes back to the fact that they came into office with no true plan, no plan that came from their spirit, from their soul. You think of the Mo Molems, the Robin Cooks, the Claire Shorts, you know, those, even Corbyn, people that have a political spirit. They could have come in and been presented with all of these changes by the Treasury, and they could have said, no, that's not who we are. But they didn't. They took the easy route, because they, honestly, I don't think any of them, probably with the exception of the Health Secretary, who I kind of like, I don't think any of them have a true political purpose.
I think Wes Streeting is a really impressive politician. I think when he does interviews, he does try and answer questions. And if he can't answer a question because of the political realities, there's always that little twinkle in his eye and that little sort of cheeky comment that gets him out of a hole, which some of the others just aren't capable of doing. And I think that is part of being a leader, not just sort of coming out with what you've been told to come out, the sound bites that you've been fed at the beginning of a media round. And I mean, some of these politicians, I mean, when they appear on with Nick Ferrari in the morning, that is one of probably a dozen interviews that they do. And most of them will just trot out the same lines in each interview. And as long as they haven't dropped a whatever, they feel they've done a good job. And, I mean, we all know the politicians that do that. Wes Streeting, okay, he will come out with some of the same lines sometimes, but it's done in an entertaining way that engages people, and that is part of being a political leader.
I completely agree, and I think when you say about cheekiness, I think that goes right to the heart of the matter with Kemi Badenoch as well, because she's slowly starting to show some character and some humour. I mean, when she was responding to the budget, yes, she spoke on script for most of it, but when I remember seeing Keir Starmer turn to Rachel Reeves at some point, and Kemi very shrewdly said, oh, is he mansplaining? And that just shows to me that she's got the humour, she can work off her feet, she's becoming adept at handling the kind of heat of politics in the moment. So I think that cheekiness, that humour, I think that's what people want, as well as a political spirit.
Well, we're in danger of agreeing with each other all the time, George, which doesn't necessarily make great radio, but I think you made some very intelligent points there. Thank you very much for your call. Deborah says, morning, Ian. Starmer's problem is his own party. They could have had the best celebration ever, but as ever, Labour infighting ruins it all. Perhaps he has too many factions to please, so ends up pleasing no one. Well, I think that there is something to be said for that as well. Andrew says, I haven't voted for Labour in the last few general elections, but this has been a breath of fresh air compared with the short-sighted chaos of the last lot. Well, I think that's what people expected it to be. They thought it would be a fresh start, that there would be real change. But I don't think many people would regard them now as a breath of fresh air. Karen's in Chippenham. Hello, Karen.
Hi. Good morning, happy Christmas and the New Year. I feel quite in despair about all of this. I don't think Keir Starmer can last, because I think Labour under Keir Starmer is going to do very badly in the May elections. And, you know, I would like Labour actually to do very well, but also all of you know, several other parties like the Scottish National Party, Plaid Cymru, the Green Party, and, you know, many others. I'd like them to, you know, really cooperate to do what's best for the country and, you know, for the local government and so on. But quite honestly, the state of our democracy and where it's going, I just feel now that the winner of the last round of musical chairs to sit at the head of the cabinet table in Downing Street, currently obviously Keir Starmer, might as well stay there, because democracy, as we always sort of thought of it, is disintegrating, and everything's being taken over now by the tech oligarchs. And when it comes to public services and how we, we build our policies, we need to really think about these things, decide what we want to do, what policies we want to have. But the government is spending billions of pounds on more IT systems, which means we'll have off-the-shelf products mostly from America, and all the policies will be hard-coded into the system solutions that we're going to be lumbered with, and we're going to have no say in the matter. And I don't even think the current government, and especially under Keir Starmer, really understands any of that. They keep talking about everything's going analog to digital, but it's just a slogan, and they don't understand what they're doing by handing over all our policy decisions to basically foreign oligarchs to make lots of money out of the tech that they're foisting on us. We should be building our own tech, you know, our own IT and artificial intelligence solutions, and keep control. You know, we need to take back control from the oligarchs, and if we don't do that, we're going to lose our democracy for good, and then that'll make it so much easier for people like, what's his name in charge of, I've forgotten his name, Nigel Farage, that will make it easy for him to sort of slip through and become Prime Minister.
Well, I don't agree with you that our entire political system is controlled by high-tech and oligarchs. Obviously, we have to make use of technology. We'd be mad if we didn't. We'd be Luddites, the modern equivalent of Luddites. Thank you very much indeed for your call. Now, coming up in the next hour, now, this is an incredible statistic. One in three Britons believe that Britishness is dependent on being born in the UK. Is that something that you believe, that you actually have to have been born in the United Kingdom to be considered British? Because there'd be a hell of a lot of people that we would have to say weren't British. I mean, Rudyard Kipling is one. He was born in India. Terry Butcher, renowned England football captain, born in Singapore. Giles Brandreth, broadcaster, entertainer extraordinaire, born in Germany. I mean, the list goes on. Do you have to be born in this country to be British?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, ice skaters Jane Torville and Christopher Dean, the Lionesses and Red Roses have been recognised in the New Year's honours list. England manager Serena Wiegmann is also being made an honorary dame. Co-host of Global's The Sports Agents podcast, Gabby Logan, receives an OBE and has told LBC she's absolutely thrilled.
It's been an amazing year for women's sport, and I am always so privileged to be part of the journey of women's sport, really, since I started broadcasting almost 30 years ago, to where we are today, the investment in women's sport, the numbers of girls playing sport, the hours on TV, radio, podcasts who talk about women's sport. It's just unrecognisable.
Idris Elba, Mira Sayal and Warwick Davis are among the names being recognised from the arts. Ukrainian officials say Russia has provided no proof it launched a drone strike on Vladimir Putin's home. Kyiv has rejected the accusation and told allies to ignore Moscow's claims. Doctors are said to be monitoring Anthony Joshua's condition following a car crash in Nigeria. The British boxer was in a Lexus Jeep when it hit a truck parked on the side of the road. He sustained minor injuries, but his two close friends, Sina Ghami and Latif Ayadeli, were killed. Latif's best friend, Mustafa Briggs, says he's in total shock.
He had not a bad intention or a bad bone in his body or a bad... I've never heard him say anything negative about anybody. I've never heard him do anything negative towards anybody. You know, everybody who knew him loved him. I don't know anyone that can say that they didn't love Lats.
Police have ended their investigation into the disappearance of a Royal Navy sailor almost 40 years ago. Simon Parks was last seen in December 1986 when the ship he was serving on was docked in Gibraltar. His disappearance has previously been part of an investigation into a man who murdered two men also serving on board at the same time. And people travelling to France via the Eurostar are being told to expect delays and cancellations. They're being advised to postpone their journeys today due to overhead power supply issues in the Channel Tunnel. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 43 points at 99.10. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.14. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the south and east with brighter spells developing, a few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
And a very good afternoon to you. It's 3 minutes past 12 on LBC. It's Ian Dale sitting in for James O'Brien all this week. Now, Britishness is a word that I think conjures up a lot of things to different people. I think a lot of us find it very difficult to articulate what Britishness actually means. But then I thought, well, is there anything which makes Britishness distinct from another nation's characteristics? Because what does it mean to be French? What does it mean to be German? What does it mean to be American? What does it mean to be Italian? I suspect people in all of those countries would have similar difficulties in identifying, well, what makes your nationality stand out from anybody else's? Well, let me tell you about a study that's being conducted by the left of centre IPPR think tank. They say the number of people who believe Britishness is something you are born with has almost doubled in the last 2 years. Now, although a majority of the public still believe that being British is rooted in shared values, a growing proportion see it as a product of ethnicity, birthplace and ancestry. This is research by the IPPR and The Guardian. They say about one-third of people, 36%, thought a person must be born in Britain to be truly British, up from one in five, 19%, in 2023. Now, supporters of Reform UK held the most extreme views. Well, the word extreme is The Guardian's word, so insert another word if you want. The most extreme views of any party backers, with 71% saying that having British ancestry was a prerequisite for someone to be truly British, and 59% saying that they believe the nation was an ethnic, not a civic community. Now, let's think about that for a minute. Let's dissect that. Because on that basis, Boris Johnson is not British. He was born in New York City. The Duke of Edinburgh was born in Corfu. What would not be considered to be British under that system? You have all sorts of different famous people born abroad. I mean, and at the moment, if you are a diplomat, say you're the ambassador to Azerbaijan, and you have a child born in Baku, well, I mean, should that child be penalised because he or she was not born within the confines of the United Kingdom? If his parents are British, that makes him British too, doesn't it? So when you look at the definition of Britishness, what do you think it should be based on? Because should it just be, I mean, we have this new term, ethno-nationalism, which was something that I have to say was something I'd never heard of until we had a guest on Cross Question who described himself as that. And to whatever the question was from a listener, he brought it back to immigration and Muslims, basically. And in previous eras, he would have just been described as racist. Because he clearly didn't believe that anybody who wasn't white could be British. Outrageous, in my view. So there are all sorts of things that Britishness could be based on. Is it to do with ancestry? Now, I mean, I've done all my family tree, gone back sort of centuries and centuries. And, I mean, I'm totally British, but I'm also a quarter Scottish. I don't ever describe myself as Scottish, even though all of my family on my father's side did come from Scotland. If anything, I would describe myself as English as well as British. So you could base it on ancestry. But if you are born here, if say your parents came here from the Caribbean in the 1950s and you were born here, do you not have the right to call yourself British in the same way that I do? Of course you do. So it can't just be based on ancestry, but maybe that is part of it. Residence. I mean, can you become British if you've... I mean, like this guy that we talked about yesterday, who's come back from Egypt after spending 10 years in an Egyptian prison. He became a British citizen in, I think it was 2019. Does that make him British just because you're a British citizen? Again, I don't know the answer to that. Is it based on values, the values that we'd like to think that we all share? Tolerance, respect for others, freedom, rule of law, things like that. But then somebody who is French would say, well, I believe in all of those things too. So can that be uniquely British? I'm not sure it can. So it is a difficult conundrum, isn't it? Because I think if you asked 100 people on the street, what's your definition of Britishness, they'd all come up with different answers. And yet it's something that we talk a lot about nowadays, partly because it does mean different things to different people, partly because we have become a multicultural society. And I think there are many people who feel that they, even if they are born here, but their parents weren't born here, whether they were born in countries that are non-white or not, find it difficult to describe themselves as British because they think they're going to be challenged for it. There's a brilliant caller that Henry Riley had on his programme on this earlier on, who was black and said that he totally considers himself British, but constantly wonders whether other people consider him British. Now, if you do come from another culture, is there anything which makes Britishness distinct from another nation's characteristics? 0345 6060 973. And do you really believe that you actually have to be born in the United Kingdom to be considered British? Now, the Americans have this rule that you can't stand to be president unless you were born within the continental United States of America. And remember, there was all of that to do about Barack Obama as to whether he was actually born in Kenya or not. There was all trumped up by Donald Trump at the time, if you remember. I don't really buy into this view that you can only be British if you were born in Britain. 0345 6060 973. How do you describe your Britishness? Nick is in Holland Park. Hello, Nick.
Hi there. Ian, happy Christmas and New Year to you.
Thank you.
It's a really interesting debate, and of course, the first thing is the difference between British and Britishness, because British seems technically easy to define. Got a British passport, bang, bingo, right?
Yep.
Anyone who's got a British passport is British. Britishness, as you were laying out, and I absolutely agree with this, is you would get many different answers, and if you amalgamated, if you took the top answers of what makes people British or what is Britishness, you probably just end up with all the kind of, you know, common tropes and cliches of being British, probably more the way foreigners see, people from overseas see us. You know, what is that? Eating fish and chips, sitting out in the rain, waving flags at royal events. I mean, I have no idea. None of, you know, to me, it's enough to have a passport and follow the laws of the land. But expecting everyone to follow the same, you know, way of life, the same life, is just nonsense. And by the way, within our Britishness, I happen to think that Englishness and Scottishness and Irishness and Welshness is probably more important to us as individuals than it is to me.
Well, I agree with that. If I'm in a different country and somebody says, where do you come from? What are you? I will normally say, I'm English. Because
Absolutely.
That's what I can... I mean, I was born in England, raised in England. I've lived virtually all my life in England. I know that I'm partly Scottish, and I've done a lot of research into my family history over the past couple of years. And I'm very proud of that Scottish heritage. Mm. But I will never be Scottish.
Yeah, absolutely. And the, I mean, I think going back to the core point of, you know, why you and your colleagues have been trading this story from the Guardian, the poll, it's purely a bit of left-wing politics to sort of beat up, you know, anyone that anyone that holds these views. And by the way, I just want to give this little anecdote about my mum. She's 94. She was, you know, grew up in the 30s as the grandchild of Jews who escaped the pogroms in Russia. And she's a terrible racist. She was complaining quite recently to me about the very lovely Asian lady who does her prescriptions in her local chemist in London, and apparently the lady was complaining about health tourism and people coming over and abusing the health system. And my mother scoffed and said, well, she can't talk, she's not British anyway. I said, how do you know that? Have you seen her passport? And of course, what my mother meant was she was Asian. And so, you know, my mother's not walking around in, you know, jack boots and going to far right rallies, but it's just a kind of.
But don't you think that's a
British English identity?
Isn't that a generational thing, though? That you would think that sort of a 20-year-old in the same position nowadays would not have that default reaction.
Oh, absolutely not. And you would never say that in public to anyone on social media. I mean, that's, again, it's a bad attitude to have. And even if you had that attitude, you shouldn't really feel comfortable saying it to anyone. So I just think it's a bit of, you know, dead news period, sort of political football for the Guardian, just to sort of beat up on reform voters, really. That's the answer. You know, who cares?
Well, I think the way they use this word extreme in this article probably says it all, because I think that a lot of people, if you just walk up to somebody randomly in the street and you say, what does the word British mean? Yeah. And, I mean, inevitably, without thinking, people will probably say, well, you've got to be born in Britain. And then when you point out to them, well, actually, Winston Churchill's mother was American. That Boris Johnson was born in America, and you go through the list, and you think, well, I mean, look at the a lot of cricketers, for example, that have played for England. Alan Lamb, who's a great cricketer for this country, I mean, he was born South African. He had a very clipped South African accent, but did anyone really question as to whether he should be playing for England? He lived here. He had a British passport, presumably, and he was one of the all-time great England batsmen. I'm not going to call them batters.
No. And half the England football team are either, you know, immigrants or children of immigrants, and we all cheer them when they're when they're playing. Of course, on the occasions they're playing well, so. Yeah, it's all, you know, that's really it. You've got to look at the politics behind, just to go back to that, you've got to look at the politics behind the Guardian story. Why are they doing this? Well, they've got to fill the newspaper this week when there's not much, you know, other politics, national politics going on. And, yeah, just an excuse to get the debate out there. But, you know, people shouldn't get so hot and bothered about it, really.
You see, you could also be controversial and say, well, why should we define Britishness? We know it when we see it. We know it when we experience it. Why do we have to define all of these things? And inevitably, in this Guardian story, it comes down to flags as well. And again, I'll say something controversial. I don't see how a national flag can be controversial at all. The Union Jack is the flag of this country. The flag of St. George is the flag of England. And anybody that is, in inverted commas, intimidated by a flag needs to give their head a bloody good shake.
I think that's a fair point as well, Ian, but isn't all of this contextual? And as you say, I agree totally. Trying to define, I mean, you know, you're going to have a constitutional paper that says what Britishness really is. That would be absolutely ludicrous. And I don't care if Britishness has different meaning and people think of Britishness in different ways. They're quite entitled to it. They can think of Britishness in a different way on different days of the week, depending upon what they see and the context it is. It's a kind of pointless circular argument. Why worry about it? You know, you've got a British passport, we're here, we're living together. As long as you follow the laws of the land, you know, everyone get on with their lives.
Thank you very much, Nick. This is a good one. And I think this applies to many people. It's from Brian, who says, Jofra Archer English when great, Caribbean when not. And it's a bit like Andy Murray when he used to win tennis tournaments. When he used to win them, he was British. When he lost them, he was Scottish. And there is something in that, I think. Look at the reaction of the a lot of people when, and I was there at Wembley when England lost to Italy on penalties in the European Championship, and the three missed penalties were all by black English players. I mean, that really did bring out the worst in people, I'm afraid. And they all are as British as anyone. Skin colour does not denote nationality, does it? Never has done, and never should, in my view. Is that a controversial thing to say? I don't think so. 17 minutes past 12.
This is LBC.
Psst, there's a Lotto draw coming up. Get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
The following is from TFL.
I got loads of flowers the other day. And messages from people I didn't even know. My mate spelled my name in tea lights. And my mom hung my favourite footy shirt on the railings. Next to the lamppost, where I got killed. By a nice lady. Just someone who thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
There's one green bottle sat on my fridge shelf. This green and white bottle that supports my gut health. Beautiful by nature, beautiful by name. It's the tastiest way to up my gut health game.
Biotiful Gut Health. Upgrade your yogurt to the UK's number one kefir and reset your gut health with Biotiful. Kefir is a source of calcium which contributes to the normal function of digestive enzymes. For verification of UK's number one kefir, see biotifulguthealth.com/radio.
At Lidl, find wines you'll love this new year. Buy any three or more deluxe wines and get 30% off with Lidl Plus, like our award-winning Barossa Valley Shiraz or Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. Cheers to that. Lidl, more to value.
Be drink away at 18 plus, subject to availability. Selected stores exclude Scotland and Wales. Selected bottles only. Ends 31st of the 12th. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
Ian Dale, text 84850. This is LBC.
19 minutes past 12 on LBC. Lots of really interesting texts coming in here. Let's take this one before we come to a call. Oh, sorry, I've deleted it by mistake. Paul says, if you have a passport that says you're British, then you are. If you don't have a passport, then your nationality is whatever it would say in any passport you applied for. I think that is possibly a little bit simplistic, but I understand where you're coming from there. Let's take another one. This is from Beatrice, who says, Grace and Perry did a fascinating programme on Britishness post-Brexit and found that there were key themes that came out across both Leavers and Remainers, and there was more in common. It was a lovely programme and brought people together. I must say I missed out on that one. Look, I think the whole Brexit debate really was a catalyst for some very strong positions on both sides. But in the end, you are no, just because you voted Remain, that doesn't mean to say that you aren't a patriot. Just because you voted Leave doesn't mean to say that you're an extremist. Of course, Leavers and Remainers had and have a lot in common. I mean, the fact that we're all British, whatever our politics, however we voted in the Brexit referendum, at least we have in common that we live on the same island. And that I think, the debate goes from there, doesn't it? We can all come up with different values that we think we as Britons have, but I wonder how different they are from the French, from the Italians, from the Spanish, from Americans, from Brazilians, from Argentinians. 0345 6060 973. Fred is in Yateley. Hello, Fred.
Hi, hello. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. What would you like to say?
Well, I will be 54 next year, and I moved here when I was about 18, 19, and I've had a British passport for, 15 years. I was born in Rome, I'm not Italian. I'm British. And I feel very strongly about it. And I think this is something that unless you have left a culture for another, you don't necessarily understand. It's not just a case of having a passport. It's a case of embracing, adopting, and developing as another culture.
And it's almost more powerful to be a Briton by choice rather than by birth, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's relatively easy, at least when I did that, let's say relatively, in quotation marks, to get a passport. But to really absorb willingly into a different society, a different set of customs, is not necessarily easy. And it takes a long time and a lot of will.
Mm.
So my partner was born in the US. He left when he was 2. Is he American? No, he's not. But according to some people, he should be considered one, right?
But do you still consider yourself Italian as well as British?
No, not at all. Not at all. And so much so that actually, to wind me up, my friends at times say that I'm Italian. And my answer is always, I'm not. I'm British. Not just because that's what my passport says, but because the way I interact with people, the way I feel about things is very much in line with Britishness, not with Italian culture. There is a culture shock whenever I visit. I don't have much family there, but if I go on holiday, there is a culture shock. You know, they're different. They not bad different, just different. Just like Americans or Germans.
But do you think, well, let me ask you this. What has Britishness got in common with, is there such a word as Italianness?
I don't know. I think they, and this is probably the same of any culture, they think that's the right way of doing things, not in a bad way. But for example, I remember hearing as a kid, possibly, that the British, that in the continent, you may know, people call the English to mean anyone who's British.
Well, Americans do that more than any other nationality.
Yeah, exactly, yes. They said they're very cold. They're very cold towards their children. They're not warm at all. Oh, my God, I have an amazing set of friends. We are so warm with each other, you know, but in a different way that maybe the Spaniards or the Italians may look at and think, gosh, they are quite cold. But we're not. Would you say we are? We're not, are we?
I don't think so. Well, I'm sure there are some people that are, but just as in any country. I mean, this is the difficulty, isn't it, with national stereotypes where you say, well, the Italians are all, they all love eating pasta, or they, I mean, we can go through every country in Europe and there is a stereotype. But there are always many exceptions to that stereotype as well.
Exactly. We often, you know, we think Italians, Spaniards are very loud, aren't they? They're very loud. And they are for us, obviously, but not necessarily in a confrontational way. Say you see a couple of Spaniards talking very, you know, gesticulating and very loud. You may think, oh, well, you know, that's just the way they are. You see two people interacting in the same way here, you think something's wrong.
The thing is, have you ever seen an ugly Spaniard or an ugly Italian?
I have.
Have you?
Just like I've seen many, many beautiful Brits.
Not so many, though, I would say.
Well, the beauty's in the eye of the beholder,
well,
isn't it?
That is very, very true. Oh, maybe we should just do an hour on national stereotypes. Well, I mean, what could possibly go wrong in that, friend?
Well, I was about to say, you really—if you want to hold on to your job, I think you don't want to go down that path.
Possibly not. And sort of stereotypical jokes. No, we won't do that because I do value my job. Thank you very much. What a great call. Andy is in Epsom. Hello, Andy.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Well, as I was telling your researcher, I was born in Chelsea in Great Britain to two Greek Cypriot parents that came over from Cyprus back in the '50s. And first and foremost, if anybody asks me where I'm from, because obviously I look a bit Mediterranean, I will say Greek Cypriot first and foremost. It just happens to be British. But I couldn't go any deeper than that with your researcher. I mean, it's not that complicated. It's the feeling.
How much time have you spent in Cyprus?
Oh, well, only on holidays. Only holidays, sort of various weeks at a time. But, I mean, First and foremost, I'm a Greek Cypriot because both my parents are Greek Cypriots. It's my blood. It's the way I feel, and I can't go any deeper than that, unfortunately, to describe how.
And this is where I think we encounter a problem, isn't it? Because if you had rung in and said that you were from Nigeria or Jamaica, and both of your parents were from those countries, and you had said, but I consider myself Jamaican or Nigerian rather than British, I think some people would give you a very different reaction to you than to you saying that you were a Greek Cypriot. And it goes back to Norman Tebbit's cricket test, doesn't it? Well, why on earth do Jamaicans who've been born in Britain, why do they support the West Indies in cricket tests? They should be supporting Britain. And then I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute. If I immigrated to Australia and England came to play cricket in Australia, I know who I'd be supporting and it wouldn't be Australia.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So my Britishness, basically, is I've got a British passport, but then I've got a Cypriot passport as well, which I obtained a couple of years ago as well. So it's a difficult one. But like I say, I'm a Greek Cypriot who just happens to be born in the UK. That's the way I see it. It's quite simple.
And I think there are different nationalities that really treasure their ancestry, possibly more than others. And I think whether you're Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot, whatever, I think those are two backgrounds that people really treasure above some others.
Maybe.
And I don't think there's necessarily an explanation for that.
No.
Maybe there doesn't need to be. Sometimes we don't necessarily have to seek an explanation, do we? It just is.
Exactly. And it's how I feel. It's just a feeling, and it's sort of been ingrained with me since I was a child, and now I'm a Greek Cypriot. Brought up speaking fluent Greek with both parents. I had two sisters, so I spoke English to them, so I became fluent in both. But, first and foremost, Greek Cypriot.
So if Greece plays Cyprus in football, you support Cyprus?
Listen, from an early age, I mean, I've never been a football fan, but Cyprus has never done it. I've learned the hard way. I don't bother.
Well, that is true. Cyprus,
but it would be Cyprus,
been...
obviously.
Yeah. And of course, in the Eurovision Song Contest, obviously you'd give Greece 12 points.
I'm close to Greece as well. I mean, I'm close to Greece as well, closer than anything else, any other country. So, I mean, I would want Cyprus to win first and foremost, then Greece, and then probably the UK. I shouldn't have said that, should I?
But you see, that's interesting, because if you are Scottish, and this is a gross generalisation, but if you are Scottish and England are playing in the World Cup finals and Scotland aren't, you kind of want any other team to beat England, don't you? I mean, that is the generalisation. I'm sure there are exceptions to that rule. And whereas, like, if there are any of the home nations in the World Cup, I want them to win. And I'm now going to court great controversy by saying that includes the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the British Isles, and if the Republic of Ireland get to the World Cup finals, I want them to win every single match unless they're playing England. There we are, I've said it. Andy, thank you very much indeed. Keep your calls coming. What does the word Britishness mean to you? It's 12:30 on LBC. Time for the news headlines with Lucinda Horsley.
Services on Eurostar have been temporarily suspended because of a power supply issue. There have been reports of long queues and disruption at London St Pancras. Ukrainian officials say Russia has provided no proof it launched a drone strike on Vladimir Putin's home. Kiev has rejected the accusation and told allies to ignore Moscow's claims. Olympic legends Jane Torvill and Christopher Dean say being awarded a damehood and knighthood is the perfect way to end their figure skating careers. Actor Idris Elba is also made a Sir in the New Year's Honours list for his youth charity work. LBC weather, cloud clearing in the south and east with brighter spells developing. A few showers along southern and eastern coasts, highs of 7 degrees.
This is LBC. Looking for a fixed passive income backed by real demand? With ulezprosperity.com, you buy the car, we rent it from you for a set period. You stay the legal owner and we pay you up to £600 per month in fixed rental income. No hassle, no maintenance, no tenants. It's a straightforward asset-backed rental agreement. Visit ulezprosperity.com for conditions and to learn more. That's ulezprosperity.com. Simple, steady, secure.
Creatives. It's time to get prepped
for the future you want. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Imad, a GCSE student in Year 11.
Alongside my core GCSEs, such as Maths, English and Science, I study creative subjects such as Media, Drama, Art and Design, Business and Music Technology, which are all recognised by the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
New year, new you. Maybe. New year, new car. Definitely. Upgrade your year with a new Vauxhall Frontera Electric or any car from our award-winning range. With 0% APR over 4 years with a minimum 20% deposit and £1,000 off on top of all other offers. That's a resolution worth sticking to. Search Vauxhall today. £1,000 saving on new car orders until the January 2026. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, 18 plus. Subject to status and availability. T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to dive into the crystal water of an ancient cave pool in Mexico. Or dry off in the sun on a white sand beach in the Maldives. Or pour yourself into the culture and chaos of a night market in Thailand. Seize the sale. Book in store and online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected travel dates apply. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com/terms.
Ian Dale on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
12:33. Danny says, morning Ian, your football analogy, did you want Spurs to... Sorry, I just had to cough after I mentioned that word. Did you want Spurs to win that European trophy? I bet you didn't as a hammer. I did, actually. I just have this thing that if you have a British team playing in Europe, I want the British team to win. I don't think that's odd, is it? Now, I have friends who always cheer on anybody that's playing against Manchester United or Arsenal or Spurs in Europe. I don't. I want them to win. I don't know what that says about me or what it says about them, but I don't think that's really weird. Let's go to Jane, who is in Hayes. Hello, Jane.
Hello. Morning. I'd have to explain everything first, and it's that bit long-winded, but it will explain the background. I'm 69 now, and I was adopted when I was a baby from birth. So I was adopted into a lovely family. My mum was from the East End, and my dad was from Chesham area. So I grew up in that family. So I was always a bit tanned, but not greatly. People thought I had some Spanish heritage in me, but nobody really ever said much when I was a kid.
People say that about me because I have slightly dark skin. I even got mistaken for an Argentinian during the Falklands War. How awkward was that?
Well, that's the sort, so you understand where I'm coming
from.
Yeah,
I do.
So when I was 50, my kids bought me a DNA kit. And when I was 50, I found my mother, my birth mother, and she was Welsh, and all of her family were Welsh. All that side of the family were Welsh. And then when I was 60, my kids bought me a DNA kit. And to my absolute surprise, I had 64% Welsh, but the rest was mainly Polynesian. As in Hawaiian. We think my father was probably an American soldier, and in the UK, because it was Hawaiian, Polynesian, mainly from Hawaii. So that was probably where my colouring came from.
What a great excuse for a holiday.
Yeah. So that's where I've come from. So all through my childhood, people... assumed I was either Spanish or Italian and would say things, you know, and I didn't know at that time. But now people are very conscious of where people came from. And I feel I am obviously British. I'm British born. I'm British brought up. I remember going to school in the snow in my wellies. I remember my parents, it was just after the war, they stopped rationing, so we didn't have, you know, they weren't extravagant with what we ate, but we had nice food. We always had to eat up what we had. On Sundays, we went to Sunday school. All the things.
You and I are so similar, Jane. I mean, all of those things that you've just said, I thought, yep, that's me.
Yeah, that's what sums up me being British. So now when people say to me, where do you come from? And I say, well, I'm English. And they say, well, but where do you come from? Where actually? And I say, here, I come from here. People, because they look at, they think, there's so many people now in this country that people presume that your background is somewhere else. And sometimes it's quite hurtful because I think I remember listening to my dad telling me stories about the war and about what he did in the war and how he went across Egypt and Tunisia and all those places. My mum was in the war. My mum was born in, you'll be pleased about this, because our family are West Ham supporters. Because
excellent.
My mum...
You can come again.
My mum was born in Canning Town, so and my granddad was a chief fire officer at the fire station in Stratford. So I've got all that in my blood, you know, all that in my background, and yet people still think, and I think it's the things that you remember that make you feel that you belong and you're British.
That is really interesting that you say that you find it a little bit hurtful when people say, no, but where are you really from? Because I remember a phoning out on this probably about a year or two ago, and I had quite a lot of people saying the same thing. And I was then found myself in the back of Uber one day. Sorry, black cab drivers, I wasn't paying, somebody else was. And this guy was speaking in an accent that I couldn't recognise. And it fascinates me listening to people sort of just talking to try and work out where they're from. But I then found myself thinking, oh, I don't want to ask him where he's from because he might take offence at that. But in the end, I did, and he was really delighted that I had asked him because I think he was from Lithuania, and I don't speak Lithuanian, and so we had a little chat about why he was here from Lithuania, sort of, and it was a really interesting conversation. But I think people are now frightened to have that conversation because they're going to be accused of being racist in some way if you say, well, no, but where are you really from? I think I said, where are you originally from?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is. I mean, I'm not offended when people say that because I am originally from here. My parents are obviously my birth mother and birth father are she's Welsh, so that could be that's sort of British. I think it's just that you remember all the things. You remember going to junior school in your wellies. You remember singing carols, you remember doing things, and sometimes when you talk to people now, they are British, but they don't remember all those things. They don't remember how we watched Morecambe and Wise on the TV. I went clubbing in London in my teens, things that people don't do now, things that you think that's all part of growing up. I remember, you know, going up and seeing the Clash play. I remember all those things that make me feel British.
This is where we differ, Jane, because you went to see the Clash as a teenager. Guess who I went to see as a teenager at the age of 15?
I don't know.
Cliff Richard at the London Palladium. Yes.
Oh, well, I liked Cliff. I did like Cliff.
What do you mean you did? He's still going.
Yes, I know. I know. My friend was actually very friendly with Cliff. I do like Cliff. Yeah, he's.
Well, I went to see him in Cardiff a month ago on a Sunday night and had dinner with him before the concert. He's such a lovely guy. But anyway, I better stop, otherwise Eleanor might take me off air. Thank you very much indeed. Great call, Jane. This is from Toby in Sussex. I don't think Britishness is so much about your heritage as otherwise how many generations would you have to go back to prove that you are British? It's also not about colour. It comes solely down to allegiance. If you were born in Britain, or your parents and grandparents were, that is not enough to make you British. Your allegiance has to be solely to Britain. If your allegiance remains to the country of your birth or heritage, you cannot be British. Well, can you really say that to our Greek Cypriot caller from earlier, that because he identifies as Greek Cypriot, and even though he was born in Britain, that he can't be British? I don't think that works, Toby, if I'm honest. You exclude a lot of people. I'd say if you were born in Britain, that surely, I mean, you are then therefore, I think, more or less entitled to a British passport. Does that not make you British? Let's go to Nick, who's in Reading. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Ian. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. What would you like to say?
Right, well, as I said, I'm probably something on the face of it, I'm a bit of a mishmash.
Well, we all are, aren't we, really? Yeah, absolutely. There's very few of us could say that we were 100%
absolutely.
British.
Totally. Well, if you argue either fully Celtic or German for the Anglo-Saxons, but that's another discussion for another day. But my background is, I was born in California to an English father and a Greek mother. As soon as I popped out, basically, my dad registered my birth to the British consulate in LA, so that would have given me... I could have just been born in this country just by virtue of having my birth registered at the consulate. And then we arrived in these shores when I was about a month old. And I grew up and spent my formative years in Reading, which last time I checked was in England. So I feel about as British and English as anyone else. So I think a lot of it's been overanalyzed, in all honesty. I remember reading in The Observer about 20 years ago about a thing about Englishness, and I think Boris Johnson, for once, actually nailed it. And he said, but Englishness isn't just going on about it all the time, which is a bit dated now.
I think the word understated, I think, should be applied
absolutely.
To Britishness.
Definitely, yeah.
I mean, that, in a way, people would say... I mean, if James was here today, he would probably... And I don't want to put words into his mouth, but he would probably say, so it's actually quite un-British to fly these flags all over the place, isn't it? That's the opposite of being understated.
Mm, I mean, I think partly... I mean, my dad got this old. He was an old-school patriot, but he felt very strongly about the flags being misappropriated. About some cheap flag from Temu being thrown half over a lamppost or being very painfully pointed on a mini roundabout. But I think I can also, by the same token, see with Keir Starmer and the Labour leadership being very, should we say, circus, but the right word? Because if you can recall, was it 10 or so years ago, can you remember the Rochester by-election when the Tory MPs did the fetch to UKIP?
Yeah, Mark Reckless.
And Emily Thornberry put in a tweet of a guy with the Union Jack. And that was manna for heaven for Nigel Farage.
Yeah, she's never going to live that down, is she?
And also compounded by the fact that she's an Islington MP. So Islington obviously being the bastion of the supposedly metropolitan liberal elite. I mean, it was almost... I remember Miliband being condescending about it, and Labour have been very circumspect about it ever since because of that.
Yep, I think you're absolutely right on that. Thank you very much indeed. As someone points out here, Cliff Richard was born in India. Yes, I think he came to this country when he was 6 years old. Does anyone seriously think that Cliff Richard, Sir Cliff, is not British? Of course he is. But he could also claim to be Indian, I guess. Now, let's take this text. It's from David, who says, when I listen to this topic, I get irritated by the terminology. The presenter uses the term the country, that's me, I guess, as if we're all in agreement as to what this means. Is Britain a country? No, it is not. Well, anyway, he continues, if you're from the United Kingdom, you might not be British, brackets Northern Ireland. Britain is an island. Well, it's a series of islands. Unfortunately, we do not have a single word to describe all the people who are citizens of the UK. Maybe it's about time we created one. Well, you'll find certainly the unionist part of Northern Ireland. I mean, they are probably more British than the rest of us. Well, that's how they think of themselves. So I'm not sure that really works. I think Britain does apply to the whole of the United Kingdom. It is called the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But you tried telling at least half of the people in Northern Ireland that they're not British, and you'll get a pretty dusty response. You might get quite a good response from the other half, it has to be said. So I think we'll leave that one resting there, because we don't want to be diverted too much in this conversation. Fascinating calls, fascinating texts and WhatsApp messages so far. Keep them coming, and we'll take some more in just a couple of moments' time. It's 12:45.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
The Cabinet Office blames an admin error on its decision to release them withdrawal papers on Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. Sportswomen dominate the honours system, and about that system, should it stay, change or go?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddie.
New in, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
The following is from TFL.
My name was Luna, like the moon.
I was 2 days short of my 17th birthday when I was killed. My killer wasn't a bad man. He had a rescue dog called Frank and rang his mum every Sunday. He wasn't a speed freak. He just thought it was okay to go a few miles an hour over the limit. But that was enough to knock me off my bike and kill me.
Speeding injures or kills over 1,000 people in London every year. Slow down. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last. Subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
When you're smiling...
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
The Hilton sale is now on, and thankfully it doesn't sound like this. Instead, our sale sounds a bit more like this.
Welcome back.
With a warm welcome, spacious rooms, central locations, and up to 20% off your stay. You can swap chaos for comfort this winter. Book now at Hilton.com. Hilton, for the stay. Offer subject to availability across participating hotels. Terms and conditions apply.
This is LBC. Message Ian Dale on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
Ben says, my brothers and I are half Scottish and half English, white, blonde-haired and blue-eyed. For his 40th, my sister-in-law got a genealogy test for my brother. Turns out that we're 1% Syrian. So what is our nationality? We're all just people. Well, that is absolutely true. And as I say, I'd find it difficult to believe that there is a single person in this country nowadays who could legitimately say they were 100% British or English or Scottish or Welsh or Irish. I'm trying not to dig myself into a hole here. I'd got one of these DNA tests about 10 years ago, and it actually switched on a light in my head because it said I was 11% Middle Eastern. And I've always thought I had a little bit of a swarthy look from time to time. I just have to look at the sun, and I do look like someone from the Middle East. And it eventually narrowed it down to the sort of Lebanon area. And I don't know how far this goes back. And 11% was quite a lot, I thought. But I've never been able to sort of discover any more information about that. So I think, look, most of us are a bit of a mishmash. And inevitably, over generations, people marry people from different countries. Obviously, there is going to be a sort of dilution of the sort of heritage, I suppose. Let's go to Jordan in Maidstone. Hello, Jordan.
Hi, Ian. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was actually just chatting to your research and saying, so I was born in the UK, British on paper. And when I was 6 weeks old, we moved to South Africa. No South African in the blood. And then 23 years later, I moved back to England. So I've been here for 11 years. But I still consider myself South African, even though on paper I'm not. And
you still got a bit of an accent, haven't you?
I hold on to it as much as I can. Makes me interesting.
Well, I think it does. And I'm one of the few people in this country that actually really likes South African accents.
Oh, do you?
I do.
But we were just saying, I wonder if it's potentially the culture that raises you. Because, you know, your previous caller who had the, you know, considers himself Greek Cypriot, and his parents are. And obviously he didn't go into much detail about it, but potentially the traditions, the family gatherings, you know, were more of a sort of Greek influence as opposed to British. And for myself, being raised in South Africa, although I was raised by British parents, my dad had me listening to Madness, watching Dinner Ladies. Yeah, whether that's a good or a bad influence, I'm not sure.
Those are the two great examples of British culture that your father inculcated in you.
Sat me down and taught me. But even, despite that, the culture, that sort of community, you know, it takes a village mentality. That is the culture that raised me. And so I wonder if that has an impact on, you know, how people relate to their cultural identity, or despite what they have on paper, if it is that you know, that feeling you get. I mean, I don't know if you've, obviously, whether you've visited South Africa or Africa or not.
But no, I was supposed to go last year to go to Mango Groove's 40th anniversary concert, but I couldn't go.
My first concert ever was Mango
Groove. Really? Oh, yes. My God. I could talk. Listen, we've got 9 minutes of the programme. Should we just talk Mango Groove for the rest of the programme, Jordan?
Have you got a penny whistle?
Yeah, I think we need one, don't we? But no, in the end, I couldn't go. But that there lies another story.
Mm. But yeah, it obviously, you know, even just listening to Mango Groove, you can feel it in their music. There's that, despite the trouble, you know, we have that unity that I don't always feel. You know, I love living here. I'm very lucky that I am able to live in the UK quite easily. But I still say I'm going home when I go back to South Africa. And that's not because I just like being British on paper. It is just the influence,
and it's completely natural. It's like I come from Saffron Walden in Essex, and I still say if I'm going up there, I'm going home, which really irritates my partner. He says, "You've lived in Tunbridge Wells for 30 years, and you still consider that your home?" Well, I do, because that's where I come from.
Yeah, no, exactly. I feel the same. But it's been an interesting conversation.
Well, it has, and thank you for taking part in it. Anyone that hasn't ever heard of Mango Groove, look them up on YouTube. Special Star, Another Country, Dance Some More. Brilliant. You'll thank me, I promise you. Ross is in Battersea. Hello, Ross.
Morning, Ian. Hope you're doing well.
Good morning. It is afternoon, isn't it? And I haven't said good evening yet throughout the whole programme, for which I'm giving myself a pat on the back. What would you like to tell us, Ross?
Yeah, I actually find this kind of, like, discussion very tedious.
Oh, dear. Well, it's made you call in, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's made me call in. But I find it tedious because the only people that really care about it are the left-wingers like The Guardian, who just want to say anybody and everybody can be British. This El Fata guy is as British as you and me, even though he's only just got to the UK. And the right, who want to say everybody who's not white can never be British. You know, my father was born in Malaysia. He was born to two British parents. He would never have in his life said, "I'm Malaysian," because it would have been a stupid thing to say. Just like if somebody's born in the UK and they've, you know, maybe got Ghanaian parents or Pakistani parents, they're British. You know, everybody knows they're British as long as they've, like somebody previously said, got that allegiance to the UK.
Yeah.
But similarly, just handing out passports to people doesn't make them British. You know, somebody like this El Fata, he was just given a passport for no real good reason, and everyone's treating it as if he's this, like, British software developer. He wasn't. He was an Egyptian software developer who said some heinous things. They should stop trying to tamper with those things.
It's not quite as simple as that, because his mother was born here. So that adds a sort of slight complication into it. And he was given a British passport because under the law at the time, he was entitled to have one.
But he'd never been to the UK, from what I understand, before then.
I don't know. He'd never stepped foot in the UK. I don't know that, but you may be right.
It's just, you know, you probably correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just what I read online, that he'd never stepped foot in the UK. He was just given a passport because his mother's birthplace, which doesn't make any sense. It waters down what it is to be British, and it's something the left is desperate to do at the moment, is basically treat it as if Britishness isn't a thing, and that anybody and everybody can be it. But at the same time, I don't think ethnicity and race really ties into it in any way, which the 36% that said that, you know, you have to be born here to be British, I think they really want to say you have to be white. Because if you said to them Boris Johnson, they probably wouldn't have said he's not British.
No, but then, I mean, you look at his family tree, and I think his grandfather was Turkish. So, I mean, if you want to sort of be absolutist about it, and you say, well, you can only be fully British if both of your parents were born and lived in the UK, and your sets of grandparents as well. I mean, I don't think we need to go down into the reeds that far, do we? I think it goes back to what I said at the beginning. Whenever I do these sorts of phone-ins, I'm always slightly anxious because I can't sit here and give you a 3 or 4 sentence definition of what Britishness means. And there's part of me that feels, well, I should be able to do that. But then I rationalise it and think, well, no, absolutely not, because we know what Britishness is. We don't need to articulate it. We know it when we see it. Thank you very much, Ross. Let's go to Nick in Chiswick. Hello, Nick.
Hi there. It's What would anybody do that had a British passport like I have?
It's a very dodgy line, Nick. We're going to try and get you back on a better one. Another Nick says, Nick in Cornwall says, I've just looked up Mango Groove. How have I got to 56 and never heard of them? They are a revelation. Thank you to you and your caller. Well, I'll say it again, look them up and you will thank me like Nick has done, because they're basically, they're a 13-piece band. The lead singer comes from Bishop Stortford, believe it or not, but I think moved to South Africa as a young child. And Sheila Fogarty has just walked in. Did you come to that Mango Groove concert that I went to at the Hammersmith Apollo almost years ago?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No. Well, I went to the Cliff Richard one.
You did, didn't you?
With my sister.
Took your sister. And honestly, do yourself a favour, look them up. They've got the most fantastic songs, and they're sort of a mixture of European pop and South African music. Anyway, Nick, that was just padding while we got Nick back on the line. He's in Chiswick. Hello, Nick.
Hi there. What would we do if everybody with an English passport was asked to do national service?
I don't know what we would do. We'd probably have to do it if it was compulsory, wouldn't we?
Yes.
I live in London.
I'm not local. No, but me being Indian, and I am very proud to have an English passport as well.
We're going to have to give up, Nick, I'm afraid, because the line keeps giving up on you. Sheila Fogarty, how would you define Britishness?
It's tricky, isn't it? Because I regard myself, I'm going to talk about it a bit later, actually, in relation to the honour system, I regard myself as Anglo-Irish.
Do you?
Yes, I very much do. Both. Yeah.
So equally.
I'm British. I'm a British citizen, yeah. But I'm also an Irish citizen. And my identity, I think, is Anglo-Irish. So it's different to my cousins who grew up in Ireland, but still has a, you know,
yeah,
the big dollop of Irishness about it, my identity. But it's definitely got a British flavour as well.
See, that makes me think I should define myself as Anglo-Scottish.
Well,
but I haven't got, because I think both of your parents came from Ireland, didn't they? Whereas it's my one grandfather came from Scotland, so I don't feel that same sense of affinity.
Identity, a national identity, can't ever be summed up in one thing. I mean, it can if you want a little sort of pastiche, yeah, or a kind of joke about it. But even then, that's risky, isn't it? But it's hard to sum up.
Well, you're going to have a great hour if you're doing this, because we're
not doing this topic, elements of identity are going to come into our conversation about the honours list, in fact.
Well, that's me done for another day. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Coming up at 4 on LBC, Simon Marks is in for Tom Swarbrick, but right now, you've just heard her, it's Sheila Fogarty.
Anglo-Irish. Thank you very much indeed. Tis, that's how I feel. Thanks very much indeed, Ian. Eurostar is ground to a halt. We'll get the details from our reporter, Shivani Sharma, who's down at St Pancras. And we're going to talk about that honour system. Sportswomen, amongst others, are all over it. Congratulations to all of them and sports broadcasters like our own Gabby Logan for fabulous achievements in their field. So good luck to them. Does the success, though, boost girls and women's sport when it comes to the sportswomen? Do we get the system right at all? Are enough so-called ordinary people celebrated? But I'm going to start with the Cabinet Office and the man we used to call Prince Andrew. Is our relationship with the royals too cozy, too deferential?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. Eurostar has told passengers not to travel because of disruption in the Channel Tunnel. The operator says there's a problem with the overhead power supply and a failed Le Shuttle train. These people speaking to LBC at London St Pancras have had their journeys cancelled.
It's chaos. Holidays ruined. I mean, I've managed to rebook. There's no tickets tomorrow, which I would have gone on if I could. I'm now travelling on the 1st.
When we first came into the station, yeah, they were still showing that they were running, but then they finally put up something that said cancelled.
Sarah Goff is stuck on the French side.
The only thing we've had at the moment is a text. We haven't seen anyone from Eurostar here. UK Border Control have been coming around, sort of telling everyone what's happening, but they don't have much information either. It really is just a standstill at the moment.
Flowers have been left outside a boxing gym in North London, owned by one of Anthony Joshua's two close friends who died in a car crash yesterday. The former world champion's being treated in a Nigerian hospital for minor injuries. It's emerged a record number of offenders are wearing alcohol tags over Christmas and New Year in England and Wales. They're being used on 4,800 people, either released from prison or serving a community sentence. Justice Secretary David Lammy has told LBC they're proven to cut alcohol-linked crime.
The sad truth is that this type of crime peaks around the festive season, and we're committed to stamping it out. These tags act as a physical and constant reminder to offenders that there's no room for slip-ups. One drink and they could find themselves back in court or even behind bars.
The oldest surviving victim of the post office IT scandal is among the recipients of the King's New Year's Honours list. Betty Brown's getting an OBE, along with actor Matt Lucas and marathon runner Paula Radcliffe. Marks and Spencers has announced it's introducing a range of meals for those on weight loss japs. The supermarket says they're designed for people with a lower appetite to maintain a healthy, balanced diet. Recent figures suggest that sales of the jabs in July rose by almost 500,000 compared with the same month the previous year. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 45 points at 99.11. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, cold for most areas with patchy cloud and sunshine. A few showers possible in southwest England and eastern coastal counties. Highs of 7 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Lucinda Horsley.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I mentioned to Ian there a few moments ago my own Anglo-Irish identity, and it doesn't connect to the first story that we're talking about, but I think it does a little bit to my take on the honours system. So we'll talk about that a little later in the programme from 2 o'clock and focus in on sport after three. So many sportswomen in particular, but sportsmen as well, have done brilliantly in the honours list and have been rightly rewarded for their superb efforts and success in their sport and all of the daily grind and effort that goes into being brilliant at any sport. So we'll talk about that a little later and whether that success, particularly in the field of women's sport, trickles down to more grassroots levels. That's later in the programme, though. I want to start. We'll also have an update in half an hour on what's going on with Eurostar and the Channel Tunnel, because an awful lot of people are being disappointed as we speak with their intentions to travel to France and on into Europe being stymied by whatever's going on there. We'll get the latest from our reporter, Shivani Sharma, in about half an hour's time. I want to focus in, though, on the relationship between the royal family and the government. It's a specific story today that has prompted me to have the conversation, but I think all year, particularly with regards to the man we used to call Prince Andrew, now Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and some of the revelations about royal finances as well. And of course, we have still a relatively new monarch, and there's a sort of sense that change is not just possible, but necessary. Probably each time a new monarch comes in, there's a sense of that. And I wonder whether you think that the relationship we have, this constitutional monarchy, parliament and the monarchy, is the right balance and the balance that was intended when it first came into being all those centuries ago. And the story that's prompted this conversation is that the Cabinet Office, present day now, not 17th century, the Cabinet Office has blamed an admin error for mistakenly sharing official papers that refer to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. A number 10 file from 2004 and 5, so going back, 20 years, relating to royal visits. And it was released as part of the government's annual transfer of records to the National Archives under that 20-year rule. It was very briefly made available to journalists before then being quickly withdrawn. And the Cabinet Office is saying, you know, nothing shady to see here. It should never have been released. It was never due to be part of public consumption. So there you have it. I suppose the fact that it is around Andrew is what makes people perhaps suspicious of that and maybe call shenanigans. The information was later redacted from the file, which means blanked out, before it was made before the file was made public on Tuesday at the National Archives in Kew in West London today, that is. And the Cabinet Office insisting it was never intended for public disclosure. Not everybody is buying that version of events, we'll see, in the fullness of time. But I wonder whether you think the constitutional monarchy that we have is in the shape it's supposed to be in terms of how it's designed. Your thoughts, 0345 6060973. Is that relationship still too deferential from the government, too cosy from the government to the monarchy? Or do you think it's about right? 84850. Sir Anthony Seldon joins me to mull this over, contemporary historian and author of recently released book The Path of Light, Walking to Auschwitz. Unrelated to what we're talking about today, but wanted to mention that. Sir Anthony, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Sheila.
Let's go back to when we founded this parliamentary monarchical relationship that we have between those two institutions of state. What was it meant to be like?
Oh, well, I mean, at one stage, Sheila, Parliament chopped off the king's head in 1649. So, you know, it hasn't always been deferential, nothing very deferential about lobbing somebody's head off.
No.
And it's been frequently frosty and cool. I think we always can look back to a golden age where everyone was incredibly humble and looking at their shoes and letting the monarchy do everything that it wanted to. Nothing like that at all. There was huge protest against Queen Victoria in the 19th century when, after the death of her husband Albert, she retreated for year after year after year and didn't do her public duty. So there was great criticism from Parliament then. So, you know, Sheila, it's come up and down.
That's interesting. Yeah, you're right to point that out. And it's funny, I met Queen Elizabeth II twice, in fact, on the same day. But the day I met her, I was part of a greeting lineup in Broadcasting House. It was breakfast presenters were meeting her as she arrived. And she moved very quickly along the line to talk to Terry Wogan, who I'm told was one of her favourites. And in it, he made some reference to being value for money as a presenter and that he was in the papers being criticised for costing too much. And she said to him, "Tell me about it," which I thought was really witty. But I just thought that's interesting because from their perspective, wealthy as they are, privileged as they are, you know, high up socially as they are, you got the sense from that comment that there's always the needle from the rest of the country, which is no bad thing. You know, in a way, there's meant to be a bit of needling, isn't there, throughout?
So, absolutely. So this is what I think, Sheila, and full disclosure, I do